to the regular meeting, Capistrano Unified School District Board of Trustees, September 15th. The meeting is now called to order. Mr. Winston, would you lead us in the pledge?
August 26, 2009, it's USD alumnus named Lance Corporal Donald J. Hogan lost his life in Afghanistan, fighting for everything we believe in and hold precious, including the business we're going to take here tonight. I would like to dedicate this meeting to his memory. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Board consideration and adoption of the agenda. Do we have a motion? Do we have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. A report now out on closed session. Item 37D2, conference with legal counsel, existing litigation. Case versus CUSD. The board unanimously accepted staff recommendation 7-0 to settle the case versus CUSD. 37D2, the third case, Beal et al. V. Fleming et al. The board voted to accept staff recommendation to settle the case on a vote of 4-0-3. Three board members recused. That would be board member Adonisio, board member Christensen, and board member Palazzo recused from that vote. Item 37D3, the board voted to accept staff recommendation unanimously, 7-0. And other items were merely discussed, so we move on now from closed session to open session. Special recognitions, Ms. Hatchell.
Good evening, President Adonisio.
I beg your pardon, we need to take a roll call. Excuse me.
President Adonisio.
Here.
Trustee Winston.
Here.
Trustee Christensen.
Here.
Trustee Brick.
Here.
Trustee Bryson.
Here.
Trustee Lopez Maddox.
Here.
Trustee Palazzo.
Here.
Student advisor Sam Alhankani.
Here.
Welcome. Ms. Hatchell.
Thank you. Good evening, President Adonisio, trustees, Superintendent Mahler, and community members. It is with great pleasure that we kick off the 2009-2010 school year honoring one of our CUSD students, Jillian Madrid. Jillian, will you please come forward? President Adonisio and Superintendent Mahler, if you'll come forward as well. Student advisor to the board, who I'd like to welcome to his first official meeting, Mr. Sam Alhankani from Dean Hills High School, will be presenting Jillian with her special award this evening.
Thank you. As our first student honoree of this school year, we have Jillian Madrid, a senior at Capistrano Valley High School. She is the recipient of the Nestle's Best of Youth Award. She was recognized for her outstanding community service, in which she started her own non-for-profit organization called Angels on the Move. Jillian's organization collected toys during the holiday season and distributed them to various foster homes, such as the Orange Woods Children Home. Her organization has grown into one that now grants scholarships for college students to purchase their books through the Upward Bound program. Jillian is an International Baccalaureate Diploma candidate with a 3.83 GPA. She is also a second degree black belt and is a member of the OC All-Stars dance team. Jillian aspires to go on to USC and to become an orthopedic surgeon. Let's give a round of applause for Jillian Madrid.
Jillian, I know you have some special people with you tonight. Would you like to introduce them?
My dad, my mom, and my little sister, Madison.
Congratulations to you, too. very much. Next, we have a special presentation from the CUSD Foundation, and with us this evening is the Board President, Enzo Scoglimiglio, as well as our Foundation Manager, Linda Wright. Will you please come forward? CUSD Foundation is pleased to present a check in the amount of $97,322.19. Did I get that correct? Okay, to the Capistrano Unified School District. These funds represent the remaining funds from the class size reduction campaign of 2008. The funds will be used for class size reduction costs for first and second grade combination classes. We would like to thank all of the parents and the community members for their continual support in our education of all of our children. Thank you especially to the CUSD Foundation for your tireless efforts to support our programs and students. You are wonderful moms, dads, and community members who have led the charge to be proactive in supporting our programs that benefit our students. Your time, energy, and of course your donations are also valued and appreciated. Thank you very, very much. I would like to ask Rocky Murray, the assistant principal of Capistrano Valley High School, to come forward. Rocky, you can stand next to me. Rocky will be accepting this next award on behalf of the CVHS Cougars, and we are extremely proud to find out that CVHS earned the honor of being the top-rated school, showing the most dramatic improvement in both the areas of math and English on the California High School Exit Exam this year. Thank you. 92% of their students taking the KC passed in English and 93% passed math, and this is an increase of 4 and 5 percentage points, respectively. This ongoing continuous improvement is a result of the professional learning community that's been established at CVHS, focusing intently on student academic achievement and excellence. Mr. Murray, will you please accept our congratulations and pass it on to your staff and students? Thank you. And finally, this evening, we'd like to introduce the newest members of our CUSD administrative team. Each of these new team members were appointed at the August 10th board meeting, filling vacancies that were created over the summer months. First, we have Candy Miller. Candy, will you please come forward? And Candy will serve as our consultant extraordinaire, that was my addition to her title, in special education. Mrs. Miller is a resident of San Juan Capistrano and brings with her a wealth of experience in special education, serving most recently as the regional administrator for the Greater Anaheim Special Education Local Plan Area. She also served as the director of special education for the Claremont Unified School District, is an instructor at the University of Laverne, and a program specialist for the Roland Unified School District. We are extremely fortunate to have a dedicated professional decide to rewire rather than to retire, and we're thrilled to have her on the CAPO team. Would you like to say a few words?
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. I started my career 38 years ago as a special education teacher, and in fact, I was the first special education teacher to be hired in my district with a special education credential. I ended my career, or so I thought, as a director of a multi-district SELPA. And now, I'm unexpectedly finding myself in a new adventure. I'm certainly working in one of the largest districts I've ever had the pleasure of working in, and I'm working in the community where I live, which is a new experience for me. I'm finding it a privilege to be here and a privilege to be working with such talented and committed colleagues in the special education department. I'd like to thank the Board of Trustees for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
Next, we'd like to introduce Gail Richards, our Interim Assistant Superintendent of Secondary Education. Mrs. Richards also comes to us out of retirement with an impressive career in secondary education. She has been named an Orange County Performing Art Administrator of the Year, an AXA Regional and Orange County Secondary Administrator of the Year, and has earned the Irvine Company Principals of Excellence Award. Currently, Mrs. Richards serves as a facilitator, a coach, and mentor for the Orange County Department of Education, and comes from the ranks of the principalship leading El Mendito High School from 1988 to 1993, and Irvine High School from 1993 to 2007. Mrs. Richards, we are excited to welcome you to the Capo team.
Thank you.
President Admisio and members of the board, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here to serve you. It truly is an honor to be here. One of the nice things about hiring someone on an interim basis is they come in and give you a new pair of eyes to look at your district. And if I start talking about all the good things that I've discovered in the first 6 weeks that I have been here, you might want to start that three-minute clock up there. The first thing I did when I came to the district was to go out and meet your principals at the secondary level, all the high school and middle school principals, and I asked them, what are your challenges for this year? Fully expecting them to talk about budget cuts and cutbacks and transition problems. And I didn't hear a word of that from any of them. What they said to me was, our biggest challenge this year is meeting the needs of our kids, closing the achievement gap. How are we going to continue to help the kids that are struggling to achieve? And then they went on to say that the people we really want to give credit to in our schools are our teachers. If you could just come back when all of our teachers are here and see the way they operate with these kids and how dedicated they are. And I want to tell you that the collaboration time and the ACE time that you have afforded these teachers to work together and embrace the idea of professional learning communities is paying off in so many ways. I can't even describe it, but you will see it when you see the test scores. Because your teachers really have embraced the idea of both vertical and horizontal collaboration. They understand power standards. They understand common assessments. They understand looking at data and making real decisions about what's best for kids. And the last thing I want to say is that your principals feel so incredibly supported by the parents of this community. Every time I brought up a suggestion that they were going to be without this or maybe be without that, they're like, well, my parents will help me. Our parents will be there for us. The parents will hold this thing together. And I'm going, really? That is truly amazing. And the spirit in which this district operates is an inspiration to me. And I want to tell you that the leadership starts at the top with your superintendent, Bobby Mahler. She challenges each and every one of us to be our best from top to bottom every single day. And that is an honor to work with Bobby Mahler. Thank you for this challenge.
And last but certainly not least, we have Peggy Bearst, who is appointed as the principal of Kenosha Elementary School. Mrs. Bearst began her career in CUSD in 2000 as a teacher at Moulton Elementary School, and she has served most recently in the position of an assistant principal supporting several of our elementary school sites. Her career in education has been impressive, spanning 18 years, where she has been a leader in raising student achievement and closing the student achievement gap. Mrs. Bearst brings with her a wealth of knowledge, enthusiasm, organization, and dedication, and we're fortunate to have her as one of our new appointed principals.
Thank you so much, Julie. Would my family please stand up? I'd just like to introduce my very supportive husband on the other side, Andy Bearst, and my youngest daughter, Casey Bearst, who attended Malcolm Elementary, Marco Forrester Middle School, and is currently a senior at Damon Hills High School. We're very proud of her. And my older daughter couldn't make it this evening. She's a 2007 graduate of Damon Hills High School and is attending San Diego State in her third year. Thank you.
Good evening, President Admisio, trustees, and Superintendent Mahler. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for appointing me as principal of Kenosha Elementary School. I appreciate your vote of confidence, and I'm thrilled to be serving the students and families of the Kenosha community. In recent recent years, the students of Kenoshita have made outstanding academic growth. In fact, today we are celebrating a huge API point increase. I pledge to you tonight and to the families and students that I will do everything within my power to maintain this path of success. As a teacher and an administrator, it has been and continues to be an honor to work for the Capistrano Unified School District. Again, thank you for this incredible opportunity. I'm looking forward to the wonderful and rewarding experiences that lie ahead. Thank you so much.
This concludes our presentations. We move now on to oral communication. I have two cards, one Kimberly Velt and Chris Corpy. Ms. Velt. You're welcome to walk over to the podium, and you have your 3 minutes, and you can speak for 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Good evening, trustees. My name is Kimberly Velt, and I have three stepdaughters that attend Bathgate Elementary School. I'm addressing you tonight because it is my hope to resolve an issue that really shouldn't have been one. In September 2008, I attended Bathgate's back-to-school night and signed up to volunteer in all three of the children's classrooms. At that time, two of my stepdaughters, their twins, were in kindergarten, and so both Mrs. Ingram and Mrs. Gilstrap scheduled me once a week alternating classrooms. I would also help in Mrs. Acevedo's second-grade classroom for holiday and special events. I went through the required process of TB clearance, life scan, fingerprinting, and was subsequently cleared by the December 1st deadline. I had already been volunteering for a couple of months, when I was abruptly told by former principal Kimberly Hall that I could no longer volunteer. When I asked why, I was told the biological mother did not want me in the classrooms because it was not my custodial time. Ms. Hall gave me a phone number to contact Darla Krause if I had any more questions. I thought this was completely ridiculous, but my husband and I contacted Ms. Krause, who was a clerk in school records. She stated that it was a state law that I had to obtain a court order in order to volunteer. But when I questioned the authenticity of her statement and asked her to fax me a written copy of that particular law, she started backpedaling and told me that I should speak to the legal department. Running into a brick wall, I left messages for Mike Beekman, then Linda Poteet, without any resolution, just that I needed to get a judge to say that I could volunteer in the classroom. In December 2008, I spoke with Mr. Jeff Bristow and explained my situation. He informed me there was no such state law regarding volunteering, which Ms. Krause had previously stated, and also let me know that I had been cleared with live scan for volunteering. He said there shouldn't be any reason why I couldn't volunteer, but when he called me back a few days later, he mimicked the same response that I had to obtain a court order. It just seems to be a cookie-cutter answer. Out of answers, I decided to speak with an attorney about my situation and was told it would cost at least $1,200 to go to court. $1,200 to volunteer in a public elementary school? I was quite appalled. With only one income plus child support obligations, my husband and I can hardly afford a hefty fee, much less should even have to. Being a step-parent, I do not have any legal, custodial, financial rights or obligations to these children, meaning I will never have custodial time with them, nor will I ever have legal parental rights unless I adopt them. I'm not a party to my husband's divorce case, nor will I ever will be. I have a copy of your volunteer handbook, and specifically the equal volunteering opportunity. Nowhere in the statement or it states that I have to get a court order in order to volunteer. I find it extremely unreasonable, and I successfully performed all the requirement steps to volunteer, and I ask you tonight to rescind last year's unfair decision and allow me back in the classroom where I rightfully should be. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. We will look into this, and someone will be contacting you.
Thank you very much.
Chris Corpy.
Good evening. I thought you might like to hear from someone in these meetings who voted for you. My name is Chris Corpy, and I wanted to address the trustees as someone who supported the recall and who voted for your elections. For Democratic purposes, I live in Dana Point. I voted for you when I was a Republican. I am a Christian. I'm not an employee of the school district, and I was once a teacher, so I have a little bit of understanding of the educational system. I've observed all of you during meetings and town halls, and I regularly discuss your job performance with my friends and neighbors, all of whom also supported the recall and voted for you. I'm prompted to speak to you tonight because Trustee Bryson commented during last month's meeting that she had the support of the community since so many people had voted for her. I'm guessing all of you feel that you have an elected mandate and are acting with the support of those of us that voted for the recall and for each of you individually. My friends and neighbors, who all supported you, have encouraged me to report to you this evening that we now all regret having supported your election. You have lost our confidence and you've lost your mandate. We have watched in embarrassment as this board has demonstrated complete dysfunction. You seem to have an agenda, but it isn't to help the students in this district. Those who financed your election and this recall, the true gorillas with the huge bags of money, have an intent that is very harmful, and you seem to be controlled by this right-wing fringe group. My personal faith and political affiliation compels me to inform you that what I voted for and what I got was two different things, and I want to take my votes back. If you think you are better than what this district had before you were elected, you are mistaken. Based upon the people I talked to, again, people that once supported you, if election was held today, none of you would be elected. Please don't blame Sacramento or Washington for our current state of dysfunction in our school district. The responsibility for your failure to improve this district or initiate real reform is completely your own. I'm ashamed to admit to people that I was conned into voting for this false reform, and I'm truly saddened to realize that it'll be over a year before the voters in this Capistrano School District will have the chance to correct this huge mistake. I assure you, we will not be conned or manipulated into voting for this dysfunction again. The puppeteers who control your agenda no longer can influence my vote or my friends' votes. Thank you.
Thank you. Trustee Bryson?
I would like to respond on several levels. First of all, to use a word like dysfunction is to ignore the statistics, one of which you heard this evening. We have a school that is number one in the state for improvement, and it was done in the past several years on our watch. That's number one. You can't take that away from the wonderful principal who achieved that. You can't say that those students didn't work harder. You can't say that the learning circles of teachers weren't effective. Let's just stick to the facts. Let's also look at the facts about the funding. Many people must have very short memories. When we came in here almost 3 years ago in November, this district was hanging on the edge of a precipice of bankruptcy. It had not posted, and this is public record, a budget in the black for 5 years. The budget has been out of the red ever since we started to work on the budget. We are in better shape now than most districts. We are actually surfing through this very well indeed, because we all had the courage to remove things from the budget which we could no longer afford to pay for. And we did it trying to defend the children in the classroom every inch of the way. You can go through the record and the numbers for the past 3 years, and the truth lies, as I have said repeatedly, with the numbers. And now you can look at the numbers and the success of this district academically. We are doing extraordinarily well, and you cannot take that from this board. We have reached a level that the other board has not and did not. So I ask you to review the facts. Dysfunction in what manner? Because we occasionally disagree. Would you want us to all be puppets and say the same thing? We are people of principle, and I'm proud to work with these people. I don't always agree with them. We're individuals. We're humans, and we have our own emotions and our own viewpoints. But the one thing I will tell you that happens in that back room in the closed session every single month is the character and integrity of the people in that room. And I do not and never will feel anything but great pride in where this district has gone in the years I've been seated on this board. And we have the numbers, both in the budget and in succeeding in classroom achievement, to prove it. Thank you.
That concludes oral comments. We move on now to public hearing, which is item 30. I'm looking now for a motion to recess to the public hearing. Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. We're in our public hearing now, item number 30. And I'll read a little statement here. This public hearing is called pursuant to Education Code 33050A to consider whether the district shall seek a waiver of several Education Code sections to avoid the expense of a special election. If the Orange County Committee on School District Organization approves the pending petition to change the district's election methodology to a bi-trustee area election process. Currently, board members are required to reside in the trustee area they represent, but are elected by the registered voters of the entire district. The petition requests that the election methodology be changed so that members of the board are elected by registered voters of the area in which they reside. If the county committee approves the change in election methodology as sought in the petition, the county committee's approval would constitute an order of election and would require that the proposed change in election methodology be submitted to the voters no later than the next succeeding election for members of the governing board. The next election for the governing members is November 2010. However, the petitioners are seeking a special election in June 2010. If a special election is held on the same date in 2010 statewide election, the cost would be in the range of $860,000, according to the Registrar of Voters. If the election is held in conjunction with the board's regular meeting in November 2010, the cost would only be in the range of $8,500, and this is again according to the Registrar of Voters. The expense of a June 2010 special election can be avoided by obtaining a waiver of certain Education Code sections from the State Board of Education prior to final action by the County Committee calling for an election. Ed Code Section 33050 authorizes the Governing Board to seek a waiver of all or part of any section of the Ed Code except for certain sections not relevant to this issue. Education Code Sections 33050 and 33051 require certain procedures before the waiver will be approved by the State Board of Education. These procedures include, number one, a public hearing on the waiver request. That is the purpose of tonight's hearing. Number two, notice to exclusive representatives of district employees and solicitation of their positions regarding the waiver. The district's exclusive representatives have received notice and their positions have been sought according to this requirement. To avoid the expense of an election resulting in the county committee's possible approval of the petition, it is necessary to seek a waiver of at least portions of the Ed Code Sections 5019, all of Section 5020, portions of Section 5021 and 5030. The proposed waiver application is part of the agenda and appears on pages 339 to 352. The board will now hear public comment on the issue of the waiver request. Mr. Kinsler.
Madam President, members of the board, good evening. I don't know how many speakers or cards you may have for the public hearing this evening. Do you even have cards on this tonight?
Six.
Six, okay.
So I'll call on each of them, and they will have 3 minutes each, starting with Jim Sigafoos. I hope I got that right. Gail Benda.
Ma'am.
And Sherry Salado.
Good evening. My name is Jim Sigafoos, and I'm a resident of San Clemente, and I'm a parent of three San Clemente High School graduates. In fact, Trustee Palazzo and I shared many hours working on various parent volunteer activities, and I'm sure she's not any happier than I am to think about how many years ago that was now. So, but we continue to still work on this district, and thank you very much for your service. I'm here, as you can probably tell from my sticker, that I'm here to ask that you do do vote tonight to request a waiver, and that would allow us to vote by trustee area in the 2010 election. Ostensibly, each of you represents a trustee area, but since you're elected in an at-large vote, you have no direct responsibility to the voters in your area. I believe that you could be more effective as trustees if we were to change that system to a system of voting by trustee area. That way you could focus on your area and really have a greater understanding of the unique concerns that exist in each of the various areas within the district. Also, I think the community in turn would enjoy greater access to our trustees and would also have more of a voice in your proceedings, and I think that would be a welcome change. Furthermore, voting by area would reduce our election costs by hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I think we'd all rather see those dollars spent on teachers rather than on reams of election pamphlets as we do today. In the most recent election, most of all the candidates, winners and losers, spoke in favor of this. Everyone that I heard supported the concept. I believe from the statements that I've seen from the board that there's at least a majority of the board members in favor of it. I'm not sure exactly, but that's my impression. And the public is certainly overwhelmingly in favor of this concept. So it's my understanding that the vote does not require a vote, as we just discussed, that we can do it by a waiver. And that seems to me to be a no-brainer. We don't need to spend money on consultants. We don't need to wait for the census. We don't need to spend money on studies. We don't need to wait for an election. In fact, we don't need to delay at all. We can do this tonight. We just need to do it. Consequently, as a voter, I ask you tonight to do the right thing and vote in favor of requesting this waiver. Voters in this district want to elect trustees by trustee area in November 2010, and I hope you'll take my comments into consideration. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Good evening. When we first went out to pursue changing the method of how we elect trustees, we weren't aware of the trend of school districts statewide changing the way they elect trustees. And most of them were doing so without going to a vote of the people. In the current economic climate, it's pretty obvious why this is being done, and I think we can all admit that saving this money to use on more important things for our schools is a great idea. But not only can we save the several hundreds of thousands of dollars on the June 2010 election, if we make the change to vote by trustee areas now, the district can save at least another $100,000 next November. It's like a double jackpot, and that's just the beginning. Every future election will cost significantly less after we change the way we vote. We will realize these savings for years to come. I understand that some of you may have some concerns about making this change without an actual vote of the people, but all things considered, it's really the only way that makes sense. In the past several months that we've been working on this, we've seen nothing but overwhelming support, and because you have followed all of the guidelines from the state to request this waiver, the information about this issue has certainly been put out there so all could be aware and participate. As a matter of fact, with the support of CUEA, CUMA, CSEA, and PTSA, in addition to the nearly 1,200 people who signed the petition, you already have far more people represented than who actually voted in the June 2008 recall election. So if a vote of 10,500 people is enough to put you in office, then I would have to say that the support of over 35,000 people is more than enough of a mandate to make this change. Another important point worth noting is that during the November 2008 election, when we were out passing out information and talking to voters, we ran across more and more people who actually thought that we already voted only by trustee area. This current process is so large and impersonal that most people have no idea who their trustees are, and that's just not right. Trustee Lopez Maddox, last month you even said that you were sure that everyone agreed that local control is better, and I'm happy to say that we agree on this very important issue. Please vote tonight to proceed with the waiver to save not just the money for the election in June, but to start realizing the cost savings that will be ongoing in all future trustee elections. Thank you very much.
Jerry Salda, followed by Aaron Cutnick.
And Jody Goodwin.
Good evening, Madam President, board members, Superintendent Mahler. My name is Sherry Saladow. I have been a community member for 22 years and a proud parent of two CUSD graduates. And tonight I, too, am addressing you about the waiver. This past year has been pretty tough with all the serious budget cuts and turmoil in this district. But tonight you have an opportunity to do something good for our district. Tonight you have the chance to save money without laying off one single employee or cutting one more valuable program in this district. The election waiver is a golden opportunity to not just save money in the short term in relation to an election, but for years and years to come. If we can make the change to electing trustees within our trustee area, future election costs will be about half what they currently are. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings every 2 years. That's money that can immediately be budgeted back into the classroom where it belongs to benefit all of our children. Asking for the waiver and going forward to make this change prior to November 2010 is what's in the best interest of this district from a financial standpoint. We're in dire straits financially, and there's no immediate relief in sight. And you've said so, Trustee Bryson. You've said many times Sacramento is not giving us good dollars. So this is your opportunity, and this is one that you guys cannot afford to miss. There appears to be an overwhelming support for this waiver, and that's the platform that this board ran on for change and fiscal responsibility. I certainly hope that tonight you will finally live up to the promises that you've made to us in the past. Thank you.
Aaron Kutnick, followed by Jody Goodwin and Robert Rydell.
Good evening, Superintendent and Trustees. During the August 10th board meeting, there was a great deal of discussion about the way that we elect our trustees and the waiver and how the two issues do and do not relate to each other. The discussion was a very good thing, but unfortunately, there was a great deal of confusion, and then a lot of misinformation was put out there. And at this point, I have to say some more was put out tonight. I happen to have an email here from the Registrar of Voters, and should this election or this issue be put on the June election, the cost is estimated between $400,000 and $500,000, which is still money we cannot afford. But the $800,000 is not a number that relates to this election. That may relate to last year's recall election, but it does not relate to this one. It is very critically important that people understand what is going on, the facts, and only the facts, and that now that there is an election waiver process, in addition to our petition process, does have a tendency to confuse these two items, and we all need to work together to make sure that all of this information is clear. What is not part of this discussion is the actual trustee boundary areas, and that's a topic that needs to be discussed separately, as it is not related to these two issues. We already have seven trustee areas, and there's absolutely nothing illegal about them. They were last adjusted in 2003, and the entire process followed all of the legal guidelines, including being approved by the Orange County Committee for School Board Organization. And I'm pretty sure that none of them would appreciate you telling them that they did not do that properly. After the last board meeting, I was concerned about the way that the trustee boundary areas kept coming up in this discussion, so I decided to do my own research. Nowhere in the Ed Codes could I find anything that stated that we had to look at, adjust, evaluate, or even discuss our boundary areas prior to changing the way that we vote. If we did not currently have trustee areas, that might be the case. But since we do have them, it's not. I also checked with the Orange County Department of Education to verify this information, and I found out that our trustee areas are legal. I was told that they are good to go, and they do not require any adjustment prior to us changing the way we elect trustees. It is very disturbing to me that a simple topic of changing the way we vote so that we can better serve our constituents of the district has to be sidelined by something that has nothing to do with it. These boundaries have been in place for almost 6 years, and after almost every allegation in the book has been thrown at this district and the prior board, not once was the issue of trustee boundary areas ever brought up. So if it hasn't been an issue for the last 6 years, and it wasn't an issue when you were all running for your respective seats, I cannot possibly imagine that it is an issue now. So please stay focused on the waiver
and how much money our district can save if you will vote to support that waiver tonight. Hundreds of thousands of dollars that can be spent elsewhere.
Thank you. Jody Goodwin, followed by Robert Lytle.
Good evening, trustees. Dr. Mahler, thank you all for your service. We appreciate it. I am here tonight as a parent and a voter to support the waiver to allow trustee areas elections at the earliest possible date. As candidates, your campaign promises stated that you support this reform and that you stated that you would advocate for election by trustee area. The County Registrar of Voters has determined that this school district would save almost $150,000 every election by electing trustees by trustee area rather than the current at-large election method. That means by voting in favor of this waiver and having the new method of elections take effect in time for the November 2010 elections, we can start saving this district millions of dollars that would have been spent on elections but can now be used directly to impact the children by lowering class sizes, retaining vitally needed staff, and otherwise improving the education of these children. The choice is simple. If you vote in favor of this waiver, you will save the district millions of dollars in the long term. If you oppose this waiver or attempt to delay the implementation of this new voting method, you are costing our district millions of dollars and hurting our kids. How you vote will determine what side you're really on. Are you for or against our kids? Thank you.
Mr. Lytle.
Good evening, trustees, Superintendent Mahler. My name is Robert Rydell. I live in Mission Viejo, and I currently have two children attending Barcelona Hills Elementary School. With regards to this waiver and changing how we elect trustees, I strongly urge you to vote no. Every single one of you makes decisions and casts votes for every single kid in the district and affects my children, every single one. Currently, and for every other voter, they're out there representing us all. So everybody that voted cast for or against every single one of you. To approve this waiver diminishes the voice of every single voter within this district. You would be setting in motion a change that leaves many unrepresented and no remedy to correct that. By that, I understand the concept has been talked about. This concept has been talked about for years. There's something wrong with trustee areas. Let's change it. But nothing's ever been done about changing that until now. Why now? I see this change as being driven solely out of political motivations. I hear the argument for doing this, but frankly, the argument, I think, for not doing this is far stronger. And that's probably why it's never been done. This is a complex issue, and if it's to be done, it needs to be done by us voters at the ballot box. So if the voters want to drive and have the election, then so be it, but I don't think you should be doing this waiver and doing it. If voters want to have the district spend money that it doesn't have to do this change, they're the ones spending the money and driving for that change because they're voters and it's their right. It's not yours, and it's not your right to really change how we elected you all and change that aspect of this time either. There are pros and cons. I will readily admit that. But my children will attend CUSD schools where elementary school is one trustee area, middle school is another trustee area, and high school is another trustee area. Which trustee do I call? Which one do I vote for that's going to represent me as I have kids in every single different trustee area? How often do we vote for people, and it's hard enough getting response and action by voters that we, by elected officials that we vote for, let alone when you're not the one voting for them? That's going to fall on deaf ears big time, and I think I just totally disagree with that. So if you make this change, 86% of you on the board, I didn't vote for. I had one sole vote out there that's not representative. It can easily be overruled by the other 86% that I had no say in. There was something fundamentally wrong with that aspect. So in summary,
thank you.
What happens if the majority of trustees vote for disenfranchising a given area, they're basically going to be out of luck. And I just, please don't do this.
Thank you. That ends the public comments, and we now open it to the board for board comments, if any. Trustee Christensen?
I don't know if the other trustees received quite a few emails on this. I have a lot of them related to why are we proposing this at this time when the school district is having so many troubles economically. Why are we even bringing this out? Well, you know, we're not. A constituent did get the petition and got the votes, and so therefore it is an issue we have to deal with. I've never really been particularly for or against either way. I can see the pros and cons on voting for, you know, district by district or overall. But lately, I would say that the first thing that came to my mind, which I brought before a couple months ago here at this board meeting, was that a person running, let's say, who's more of a politician than not, will find it easier to win an election if it's district by district. For one thing, you could have a special interest group fund quite a bit of money that no one else could match if they're just getting $50 from this person or that person. So it would be easier in some respects to win an election in a certain district, and because of that, if they wanted to continue rerunning 4 years later, they would really put an emphasis on their district and not as the area as a whole. But I don't think that really is as important as the fact that actually what Robert Rydell brought up is that as a person in a district, you have a voice right now to vote for everyone in the district who all have a voice in what's happening to your child at each school. And I think it would be a shame to disenfranchise, if you want to use that word that's been many times used over the last election, the constituents where they won't have a say anymore as far as what the majority of the board is going to be and how they're going to vote. And as far as the waiver, whether or not we vote for it or not, even if we didn't vote for it, there is a chance that it could cost the school district $500,000, $800,000, whatever that number is. But there's also an equal chance that it won't, and that the committee will just say, you know, we don't want to do this to the school district. So, you know, spending these funds, and so with or without the waiver, those funds may not spent. But the problem with putting that waiver in is that it doesn't give a chance for the voters to determine whether or not they want the election is district-wide or not. And I think that, out of the three reasons I just brought up, is probably more important than any of the other reasons, is that it's really, truly should be up to the voters of this district of what they want, not specific people who are giving us emails or speaking at the podium. But we should have a vote from the entire school district. If they want it, fine. If they don't, fine. You know, either way. Thank you.
Trustee Winston?
Thank you. Like those who have pointed out that there are good and interesting arguments on both sides of this issue, I share that point of view, and I'm one who ran for this seat by saying that I thought it was an issue deserving of serious study, and we have been engaged in serious study on this, all of us. And through that process, I'm probably more confused and less certain which way I think is best. But one thing I'm certain about is that I believe the process that should be engaged in shouldn't be by us making a decision, seven people making a decision for $200,000, or the county committee 21 or however many are on it, making the decision for 200,000. But I concur that a decision on this should be made, if at all, by the voters in a general election. But before we get that far, I'd like to ask Mr. Kinsler some questions based on some of the comments we heard tonight. There seems to be an issue on the potential cost of the special election. And do you have information on that?
Thank you, Madam President, Mr. Vice President, members of the board. I've heard various numbers bandied about and some, I think, perhaps loose terminology. And there's probably a good excuse for the loose terminology and the ambiguity in the numbers in this situation. The legislature hasn't done us any favors in terms of how they've worded things in the elections code and the education code as usual. But the numbers that we have been presenting to you in the materials tonight and at the August board meeting are accurate. California law makes clear that school board election issues, any election, trustee elections, bond elections, what have you, will be held on an election date. And in the election code, that specifies a series of election dates. There's a date in March in odd years, there's a date in April in even years, there's a date in June in even years, there's a date in November in even and odd years, if I recall right. Those are all the regular election dates. And so there's been, I think, some confusion about what election is what. Your board's regular election date is November, is the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of even-numbered years. So that if there were an election in June of an even-numbered year, well, that is a perfectly lawful election date as a general proposition, it would be a special election. You would not normally have anything on your ballot then. That election, because it's also a statewide election, would be run in all of the jurisdictions that comprise your district, I believe. I know they would. Other dates, that would not be true, and that would cause the cost of the election to escalate significantly. And that's where you start to hear numbers like $800,000. Number for the special election in this June is based on receipt of information through the Orange County Department of Education from the Registrar of Voters, estimating the range for the June special election at $403,000 to about $496,000. We've been saying about $500,000, but those are estimates. It could be more, it could be less, I suppose. The cost of a November election, because that's when you're already on the ballot and already going to be budgeting for the 10-11 year, the cost of that election is a relatively small number, I believe $8,500 for the additional cost of that item.
Okay, so you're certain about the $500,000 estimate?
Based on the information from the registrar. Yes.
So where did we get the $800,000 from?
That comes from the notion that the election would be on a date where, on a date other than, say, the June or November election, where the entities that comprise the district may or may not also be having an election, and there would not be the opportunity to prorate, if you will, the costs of that election.
Okay,
we've cleared that up, I think. What are our options tonight on this vote? I know we could vote yes, full speed ahead with the waiver. We could vote no and torpedo it entirely. Are there any other options?
You could, for example, you could condition the vote, I suppose, on what the county committee does. You know, and irrespective of what you do tonight, you always have the opportunity to revisit the issue.
Can we, we've had our public hearing, would that suffice to continue this over for the October meeting after we know what the county committee is going to do on September 30th?
Well, I believe that you would probably need to proceed to a vote up or down or otherwise on it tonight after the public hearing. But if you were to vote no, just like any other action that a board takes, you can always take action to rescind action previously taken and authorize the issuance of the waiver.
There were some timing issues we discussed in August, I think.
Yes. We were talking then about which State Board of Education meeting to try and get the waiver on, and we were up against a pretty insurmountable timeline to try and make the November 5th and 6th meeting of the State Board, I believe it is. They needed to have the waiver request. I think the deadline was August 31st, and schools were not in session. You wouldn't have had the opportunity to seek the input that, you know, that was sought. And so it was felt that while there would be some risk associated with having the county committee meet before getting the waiver from the state board, that was inevitable, one, and two, that at least in a rational world, the county committee would not force on you an approximately $500,000 expenditure.
So what timeline are we on now with the waiver?
Right now what we would be shooting for would be the January, early January state board meeting, if I recall correctly.
Which gives us a lot of time to react to the county committee decision.
Yes, perhaps so. And what I mean by that is if, for example, the county committee were to adopt a resolution calling an election, while we understand from the state that they have in the past approved waivers after county committees have acted, there's no guarantee that they would do so. We don't have anything, if you will, committing them to that position, but we do and are aware of past decisions consistent with that.
Okay, thank you.
Trustee Palazzo?
Yes, a question for Mr. Kinsler. The county committee that will be meeting on September 30th here, they have the, it is up to them to, they can vote not to have the election. They can vote to have the election in June 30th. And they can, or they can vote to have the this put on the ballot in November of 2010. Is that correct? They have, so they can choose to have the election in June of 2010 or in November of 2010 or not to do it at all. Is that correct?
That would be correct. As part of their, and I'll use a new term here, they have the decision, they have the authority to decide whether to order an election, first step, or not.
Okay,
if
so
they do, they can set
so
other
if,
dates you're calling.
If the board voted for the waiver tonight, let's say, and the committee voted to have the election in June, costing us the money, we might then be able to save that money if the state granted us the waiver. Would this waiver supersede their decision to have the election in June?
It may. If the board were to adopt a waiver tonight, And if the county committee was appearing to be inclined to a June 5th date, our position would be that they ought to hold off reaching any final decision so that we could hear from the state board on the issue of the waiver.
Okay. And would, if the county committee did go for the June 2010 election, and our appeal to the state because we went for the waiver, would that have some weight in our appeal to them saying we're trying to save our district the $500,000? So please give us...
You would certainly think and hope so.
Thank you.
Trustee Brazen?
We honored a gentleman tonight who won't grow old in this district, although I understand he's part of the district. When you did our pledge, a young man who won't be coming home. One of the key things that he was fighting for there were the rights of the citizens of the United States of America. And what is the key right that we have? I don't know how many of you have ever been in a communist nation when it was a communist nation and actively been approached by secret police, all kinds of things, because you wanted to just have normal conversations. I don't know how many of you understand that the freedom we have here is the greatest freedom that has ever been given to a people in the history of the world. And we fought for it, and we have young men who sacrifice and fight for it today, and women who fought for it, and people of all ages who've lived and died for that. I think the right to cast a vote is a critical right and a foundational right in this country. We have people who have voted before in this, and we may have people voting again, either $8,500 to have the vote, $500,000 to have the vote, whatever it is, that vote, whenever it comes, and whatever the outcome, has to be respected because that is the will of the people, and that is the greatness of this nation. But a lot of people gave everything they had so that we can go cheerfully and vote or absentee or to the polls with our family and friends to say how we feel about a school board or something much larger than a school board. And to me, that is the most foundational, fundamental right that we have. And I hope we protect it with our vote.
Trustee Lopez Maddox.
Mr. Kinzler, I went through a redistricting process roughly 10 years ago, and I don't pretend to necessarily be an expert on these issues. I kind of went through the process and was made familiar with some terms and some methods in drawing districts. And there were certain key things we had to pay attention to when we were putting those districts together. And one of the terms was communities of interest, and of course that's somewhat open to us to what that could be. It could be racial, it could be city, county, lots of different factors could be weighed in and identified as communities of interest. I have serious reservations that if we were to go forward with the current districts and do it by district under the current districts, given that when those districts were drawn, they may not have been drawn keeping state law in mind, if it were to be done by elections by district, and we could find ourselves in violation of the Voters' Rights Act, should we go forward with elections by district in the current districts? Could you respond?
Sure. If it were the case that you were to proceed to a trustee election, not the election on methodology, utilizing the current trustee areas, they were not based on the evidence that we've seen on total population. They were based on registered voters. As a result, what you've got in the areas that are used now for your at-large by trustee area system is you have a variance from average by a total of 37%, which means that if you relied on the districts as they are, you'd be clearly in violation of the federal constitution requirement, the equal protection clause requirement of one person, one vote. And that's why, as part of this equation, and it certainly is easy to confuse issues here, but this is the next step issue. It also is deserving of consideration in all of this, that you are going to need to quickly address the question of the composition of those of your trustee areas if you change to by trustee area elections.
Okay, and if I may, some follow-up questions, Madam President. If we were to go forward and do this by district elections, would a demographic study be required before we could move forward with redrawing the lines?
Yes, you would need that.
Would there be a substantial cost associated with that demographic study, since it's given that it's occurring prior to the census, I believe?
The answer is yes. And in the current environment, I would be irresponsible if I made light of figures that were tens of thousands of dollars. No matter what we're talking about, we're talking real dollars. But in speaking with the our expert demographer, you're probably in the range of $30,000-$40,000 for that process. If you do it prior to the census, the process is more complicated because a demographer would need to rely on the 2000 census plus pulling in a bunch of other information, updating that given changes in population that have occurred over the decade, and then you would pretty much immediately after, say, a November 2010 election, you would have the results of the 2010 census, probably in the spring of 2011, which would require a rearrangement of those boundaries previously drawn. That would be a much less expensive process. You wouldn't be starting from zero at that point, but certainly you would be engaging in some repetitive costs that way.
Thank you.
Trustee Palazzo. Oh, Trustee Brick.
So in regards to the county committee choosing the, if they chose to do the June election, to have this put on the ballot in June, not only the cost of the election, $500,000, but now Trustee Lopez Maddox has brought up the cost that we would have to redraw the boundaries according because of some voter, the Voter Rights Act. So I just wanted to point that out so we have that both. The second thing I wanted to ask you, if we voted for the waiver tonight and the committee chose to put the election in November of 2010, so the first election by trustee area would be 2012, could we pull back from the waiver? Could we just say to the state, no, we don't want to do the waiver because the committee has chosen to do the election in 2010?
The answer would be yes, that it's not uncommon for waiver requests to be pulled right up to the minute of state board action.
So a vote tonight for the waiver to protect, to try and stop, if possible, the election to be held in June, but rather go for the November 10th election, would be that is something we could do and just pull out and not go for the waiver if they did indeed decide to do the election in 2010.
Right. And also recall, members of the board, that you have adopted and will be on the county committee's agenda your proposal, which specifically requests the November 2010 election date.
Trustee Brick.
Mr. Chancellor, do you know of any other districts in the area, relatively, that are going through the same process as we?
Off the top of my head, no, not in this area.
I know Long Beach is just a little bit larger than we, and they've been in by organizational, and have been what I think is pretty successful in handling that kind of an operation. Have you had any experience dealing with them?
I dealt with the community college district and its move to trustee areas.
So that's the trend.
The trend is certainly towards elections by trustee areas. In terms of any empirical evidence of that, I don't have any, other than, you know, I do know that in other portions of the state, districts are under threat of litigation because of representational issues with respect to the composition of boards.
Thank you very much.
Trustee Barson, your light was not on. Trustee Barson. I'd like to weigh in on this just briefly. I concur with my colleagues, actually. I really was not wed to this too much one way or the other. I think it seems like it could be a pretty interesting idea to have people elected by their area. On the other hand, it does bring up the issue where we have only then, the constituent has only one vote on the board rather than voting for everyone. That's a big deal. If you have students in three different schools within the district, who knows, you may not have that vote available. That aside, because there was a lot of room for change and adjustments at that level, my real concern is that the decision be made by the voters. That is my real concern. Thus, I would leave this up to the voters to make the decision. Thank you. That's it. Are we finished with our comments?
Just maybe a point of clarification. This is going to be going before the county committee as it stands. Does this board then want to make a request of the county committee on how we would like to see it handled? I know there's a way, but perhaps there's been some changes of the mind this evening. I don't know.
Actually, we sent a resolution earlier indicating that regardless of if they vote for this at all, that they set it up for the November election, and that we did not give our opinion as to whether we wanted it to be voted one way. We didn't say yay or nay. We just said if you vote for this, we would appreciate it being done in November.
That's my recollection of it. Perhaps we would want to amend that request that it be placed on the November ballot and left up to the voters of this district to decide how they wish to pursue the elections in this district.
I believe your action last time, it may not have included all of your statements, certainly has that effect. It certainly seeks an election in November of 2010 on the change in methodology.
Apparently we have several attorneys.
You're looking for a stronger comment to that. You're looking for a stronger comment, are you not?
That I don't want it to be ambiguous at the county committee level on what we're looking for. So I just want to be very clear on what we're asking the county committee to do.
Sure. We, meaning the board, hopefully you'll invite me along for the ride, will be able to have an opportunity for considerable input, I believe, at the county committee meeting itself. And certainly the point that you're trying to make, I don't think will be easy to miss.
Okay, thank you.
Does that conclude our Public comment. At this point, I'm looking for a motion to adjourn the public hearing and reconvene our regular meeting. Do we have a motion to adjourn the recess and begin our meeting? We vote after we get into our regular meeting. Do we have a motion to...
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you very much. The public hearing is adjourned. We're back in session at our regular meeting. We are returned to the regular meeting. If anyone has a motion or vote with regard to item number 30, now would be the time. What's your motion, Trustee Bryson? I call the question. I move that we vote on number 30. All right. What are you? What is you? You're requesting a vote of what? You are a motion to do what?
A motion to vote on the waiver up or down.
You're making a motion then. Your motion is to
approve the waiver.
Exactly. Up or down. We have a motion by Trustee Bryson to approve the waiver. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
No, that is not what I meant.
No. Look for clarification from Trustee Bryson.
I'm sorry. No. I just wanted to call the question. I do not want to...
Correct. I understand.
Motion to approve. No, I withdraw my...
I understand. We are now in regular session. If someone has a motion to make, please do so.
Regular session.
Thank you.
I make
there being Trustee Bryson, what is your motion?
I'm sorry. I move to vote against.
Okay.
The waiver.
I'll second it.
So we have a negative. Okay.
So a yes vote means you're voting against the waiver, right?
Trustee Bryson, your motion is that we decline the waiver.
That is correct.
Trustee Maddox, you have seconded the motion to decline the waiver.
What about the
There's a motion on the table to decline the waiver. Shall we have a roll call, please?
Is there any discussion?
To decline the waiver.
Trustee Brick?
No.
Trustee Bryson?
Yes.
Trustee Palazzo?
No.
Student Advisor Sam Alakani?
No.
Trustee Christensen?
Yes.
Trustee Lopez Maddox?
Aye.
Trustee Winston?
Yes.
Trustee Adonisio?
Aye. The motion to decline the waiver has passed 5-2. We move on now.
What about our constituents?
To our consent calendar. The consent calendar includes items 1 through 29. Do we have any trustees pulling any items? Trustee Palazzo?
Number 11.
Thank you. Trustee Brick?
14, please.
Any other items? Thus, on the consent calendar, item 1 through 29, with the exception of items 11 and 14, do we have a motion to approve?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Trustee Brick?
Yeah.
Trustee Bryson?
Aye.
Trustee Palazzo?
Aye.
Student Advisor Sam Alakani?
Aye.
Trustee Christensen?
Aye.
Trustee Lopez Maddox?
Aye.
Trustee Winston?
Yes.
Trustee Adonisio?
Aye. The consent calendar with the 1 through 29, with the exception of number 11 and 14, has passed. We now move to item number 11, Trustee Palazzo.
I have a question about the purchase orders on page 84. In regards to the International Baccalaureate, it looks like there are about $10,000 worth of conferences for the International Baccalaureate program at Hankey. And I have some concerns about this in that we have never talked about the International Baccalaureate program for Carl Hankey. I am very supportive of the International Baccalaureate program. We do have it at a couple of our high schools, but I'm concerned about the money. Now, I've been told that the PTA is funding the conferences, but I'm concerned about who's funding the rest of the program at Carl Hankey. We don't know anything about it. It's not been brought forth to the board. I also have concerns for the PTA. What have they been told, or what has Carl Hankey been told that the board is doing? I know, and some of our trustees and maybe some of our constituents don't know that our teachers are being released now to attend conferencing rather than the $90 a day that has been in the past. This year, because of Ed Code, et cetera, it's going to cost $350 a day for the substitute. So these are my concerns, this cost. What is this about? What is this conference? How did $10,000 worth of conferences get on the purchase orders when we knew nothing about it?
Superintendent Muller?
Mrs. Palazzo, I'd be happy to respond to this. As I understand it, the approval for the International Baccalaureate program at the K-8 Hankey School was conducted within the Education Department in the month of May. It needs to come, according to our policy, it does need to come before the Board of Education, and we plan such in the month of October. So Dr. Wilbur will be coming here, and he will be presenting the concept to the Board of the International Baccalaureate Program, with the understanding that his school, Hankey, is a feeder school to Capistrano Valley High School, which has the International Baccalaureate Program. And I would assume that that is the reason that the item did not come before the board, because it was the same concept, it was the same program. Meanwhile, however, the training of the teachers for this program has a set schedule. And the school does have, as I understand it, PTA funds to pay for that training. The training, though, is, as I also understand it, on a Saturday. And that's as far as I've been able to research the item. The training is good training regardless of whether the trustees approve the baccalaureate program for Hankey or not. It is still valuable training for teachers at an 80% consensus of the school who are willing to give up Saturdays in order to receive it.
Do you have any idea what the cost is? Because with our $25 million that we're going to be having to cut from 2011, you know, every dollar that we save this year means $2 for 2010-11. And I'm just concerned. I am totally, of course, in favor of the program. But looking, is it being funded by the school? Or are they expecting it to come, the whole program, to be funded by the PTA? Or are they going to come and ask us for money?
They have a variety of categorical programs that they are entitled to.
But have they been swept?
No. No, what I mean is these are categoricals that have not been swept except for one, which at the time this was approved had not been swept, which was the SIP monies. So Dr. Wilbur and his PTA are going to have to find a way to replace that money which has been swept, and they, I believe, are prepared to do that, to raise the money. It's $3,000.
Okay, I just, you know, want to go on the record as saying that we didn't know anything about this.
I understand.
And so that, you know, if cost-wise it looks like they're going to come to us for money, it is a decision that we will have to look at. If they're funding it themselves, of course, that's a different matter. Thank you. Trustee Bryson?
I do have one or two questions, and I regret that I was not able to notify you of the questions.
Is this on the item number 11?
Yes.
Okay.
This is all on item number 11, which is why I didn't mention it, because Trustee Palazzo brought it up. On page 80, I have several questions on page 81, the grouping of Pepperdine University here in the 20,000s, 30,000s, so forth, down the road there, down the row. We had discussed, Ron, at some point, and I don't know if you've already dealt with this, with the Pepperdine arrangements or not, that all consulting firms should be revisited and asked for a 10% reduction, some kind of reduction, hopefully 10%, if not some other amount, because the days of everybody having a lot of money to throw at consultants are long gone, never to come back, I don't think, really, for a very long time. And have they been cost-effectively asked to reduce some of their fees? Because these fees are high, and there are a lot of them.
Since that's something that isn't handled out of our department in business services, I don't know if there's someone that can address that specifically
that's
here this evening.
Question.
Trustee Bryson, I know that we had conversations early on in the year with the Pepperdine and the counseling, and I believe that these are all funded through a grant.
These are all covered by a grant. Is there some indicator there where I can note?
No, but what I would like to do is get more information regarding this grant and then get that to you. Yes, Mike, are you here?
Mr. Beekman.
These are part of this is part of the Safe Schools Healthy Students Grant, and we did go back to Pepperdine, and they did give us a credit of $17,000.
Thank you, Mike, so much. I'm thrilled. Thank you. There are a few more little questions here. Where it says Centralia Elementary School District, $45,195. Can you explain to me exactly what that is?
I believe that's cost for servicing a special education student of ours that is placed within one of their programs.
Is living up there?
I don't know where the student is living, but I believe the student is receiving services within their program, and those are costs that they're charging us for placement of that student.
Okay. In other words, we had nothing in our district that would serve the needs of that special ed student?
That would be my assumption.
There is a possibility, since I was superintendent in that school district and have some knowledge of it.
I'm sure.
There is a possibility that the youngster is either in a specialized deaf and hard of hearing program,
okay,
because Centralia services children from about 13 school districts in that program. And the other possibility would be that the Centralia School District has a number of temporary group homes and so on that may have something to do with a youngster attending there whose residences would have been here. But we will get you the specific information.
Thank you very much. On page 82, and this may be something similar, but there's no indicator. There's no way to know for me to just look at it. The Oak Grove Institute, $24,000. It's a residential. Is this another special needs student? Do we have a special ed person here?
I'm looking for that. It's non-public school. It's non-public school.
You can all volunteer at one time. It's okay.
In other words, these are
special education, non-public school placement.
Right. Okay. Then in leisure care, what do we consider leisure care? I couldn't recognize that. What is leisure care? Who has the leisure to do leisure care?
It's where I'm going as soon as I can.
I'll join you.
It's non-public school placement as well. I think Pam's looking up the purchase order, so we'll give you a specific on
leisure care?
It's nursing services.
Can we have some kind of, even though it says NPA, not public agency, and I see that now, and I see the IDs on that now, but if there were some way to put something about special ed on these so that we can quickly ID that what they are and then not be concerned about that.
Mrs. Bryson, if I may, Ms. Adonisio and Mr. Christopher Pittman and myself have had quite a discussion about
ID,
looking at our computer software programs to see if we could not possibly indicate which items may be categorical in nature and not funded out of the general fund.
That would be a huge help. That would be a huge help. Last question. No, she answered that one. One second. That's it. Thank you very much.
Trustee Brick? Is your question on item number 11? We'll finish up item number 11, and I have you marked for item number 14. Do we have any more items with regard to item number 11? Any more questions? That said, do we have a motion to approve item number 11?
Second.
Motion to approve, seconded by Trustee Lopez Maddox. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion carries 7-0 on item number 11 passing. Now we move on to item number 14, Mr. Brick.
Thank you, Madam President. One of the issues I noticed in there was that we are piggybacking on getting supplies, actually through the Unified School District in Santa Ana. As part of that, there's a requirement for them to be checked or screened in some fashion. And I know myself, as well as my colleagues here, we're concerned about people coming onto campus. We don't know what their business is. We went through a big volunteer situation, as many of us remember, not too long ago. Well, now we're having some people coming on. There is a clause in there that talks about being fingerprinted. Is that all that happens? I don't really know. What entails the investigation? Who has access to the facilities. It's all part of the contract, but are these people living up to it? Do they wear badges? Are they clearly identifiable when they come onto a campus? I think we need to look at this and share with you anything else that we have.
Mr. Brick, are you referring to this particular piggyback of supplies that are delivered to us, perhaps by people who are unknown to us that come on our campus, or are you asking a general question?
Well, we don't know who's coming on. Not the badge.
This paper is being delivered directly to our warehouse and then distributed from the warehouse by our own people.
Okay. So that was a boilerplate statement that appeared in the contract.
Can you refer me to the page you're looking at? Or was that some of those in backup?
I believe it's 137. Yeah, item 33.
I believe that's a boilerplate comment within their contract.
Correct. In order for Santa Ana Unified School District to award this contract, that contractor has to abide by these terms and conditions. And in order for them to do that, they have to prove that they've been fingerprinted and before they can enter into that contract.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any further questions on item number 14? Do we then have a motion to approve item number 14? We have a motion to approve by Trustee Brick, second by Trustee Bryson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? 7-0. Okay, now we move out of our consent calendar. Item number 31, reinstatement of program services management personnel. Ms. Brettlinger?
Thank you. Item 31 here brings back to the board a restoration of a 0.25 of our coordinator of the community education program. We are happy to see that this program is expanding and have plans to continue to expand it as an outreach to our communities. As a parent, I have my own child who has been afforded the opportunity to participate in some community education programs at our own elementary school. And with that, we would like to increase the 0.75 that was reinstated earlier on back to a full FTE with the CUMA cuts applied to it so that we can go ahead and continue to expand the program. I'd like to mention that this position is funded entirely out of the revenue that is...
I'll move approval.
Second.
So that there is no cost incurred on the general fund. And what's new with it in this board item here is that anything that exceeds the cost will directly go into the general fund and hopefully be a revenue enhancer for us in the future.
Discussion by the board? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion carries 7-0. Reinstatement of program services, item number 32, preliminary financial statements. Mr. Webbs.
President Adonizio, members of the board, Superintendent Mahler, good evening. And here we are starting off our new fiscal year with our first budget discussion. I'm going to predict we're going to have at least one budget discussion a month before the year's out, as we have a lot of ground to cover this coming year and a lot of work to do as well. While this is coming up on the screen, let's see if I need it. Okay. Well, while that's coming up, I'd like to point out a couple of things. You have three handouts that. Okay, here we go. I'm losing my crowd. You have three handouts. And I wanted to point out that these handouts are contain some minor revisions from the information that had been posted to the web that was originally put out on Friday of last week. As I kind of mulled this over and thought about it, and you know, when you do a presentation, you think about it and you think of a little bit better way to put it forward that can explain it easier. That's simply what we're looking at tonight. I made some minor revisions to it. So I would draw, first of all, your attention to the PowerPoint, the handout you have. The second one is a recap of the financial statements. What we did is we took the recap that we did in June. If you recall, we put together a simple recap and kind of expanded it out so that we could use it kind of as a multi-year look, because we're going to have a little bit of a short conversation about the multi-year projection. And then the third item is a colored sheet that's kind of like a red light, green light sheet that shows you all of the cuts that we made in April and what happened with those. Were we able to achieve those, and how much were we able to achieve? So that's there for your, you know, perusal. You can look at that on your own time. We're not necessarily going to review that this evening, but this is posted to the web as well. We did very well with the actual savings on our budget cuts, $25.6 million when we had projected just right at 26. So we did very well on those cuts that we had set out to do. Okay. First of all, I just wanted to just recap very quickly what we're here to do this evening. And in the budget process, as you wrap up a year and start a new year, there's a few things that take place. And the first thing that we did in this process was the board adopted the budget for 9/10 on 6/24/09. What subsequent to that, we move into April, the year's closed, we begin closing up the books, and we need to make some adjustments within that to adjust our budget to our expenditures and to transfer some funds. And you approve that on item number 19 in the consent agenda. The next item is the GAN limit, which is something we have to do every year. It's a pro forma process that we do. You approve that in item 23. So that what we're here at this juncture to do is to approve the unaudited actuals and reappropriate carryover funds. And this, what the carryover fund is simply is you have ending balances in the 1 year in accounts, and you carry those forward and open up your books for the next year. And then also, while this particular requirement has been waived this year, because in terms of timeline, we have typically 45 days from the adoption of the state budget for us to revise our budget, and the 45 days, I believe, if I counted correctly, expired yesterday, but that time factor had been waived because the budget was really adopted, first of all, back in February by the state. If you recall, they adopted an 18-month budget. Anyway, those are the things we're here to do this evening. The next slide, what I wanted to show is, subsequent to the board approving the budget in June, the state then adopted their budget, and some things happened, and most of the things that happened impacted us negatively. So I wanted to address those. If you recall, we had had a conversation throughout the spring, late spring, about that we figured that we were going to get an extra cut of about $4.2 million, but we were hoping that we were going to get federal revenue to offset that cut. We're going to have to recognize the cut, but we are not able to recognize the revenue that we're hoping to get from the federal government. So let me walk through what has happened as a result of the budget adoption, the state budget adoption. We have to recognize in our financial statements, and these items have been adjusted already, an additional revenue limit cut of $4.26 million. We knew that was coming. The next cut on there is another additional revenue limit cut of about $25 per ADA, a one-time cut of $1.2 million. I'm sorry, an initial ADA ongoing cut of $1.2 million, excuse me, and then a one-time revenue cut for 9/10 of $1.5 million. The state also made a cut to home-to-school transportation of about $170,000, another cut to special ed transportation funding of about $440,000, and then there's an offset to QEIA funding of about $390,000. That means that we get the federal money, the QEIA money, and then they're pulling that out of our state revenue. But the good news is there's a bill on the governor's desk that would back this out and correct this so that money would end up coming through, and I don't know what the status of that is. I know that it's sitting on his desk looking for approval. If there's any good news in this, we ended up getting a few more dollars per ADA for lottery. When you put all of that together, we've had to recognize and acknowledge within our budget, and we have done this, and I'm going to show you in a minute how we did it, of the $7.8 million beyond that $25 million from where we were at budget adoption in June. Any questions on that? Okay. I'd originally titled this the ARRA Federal Stimulus Money Update, but really it expands just a tad past that, and I wanted to address a couple of key components of the federal money. We were anticipating, our calculation was that we would have about $4.9 million in additional federal stimulus money, the American Recovery Reinvestment Act money, the second round. However, at this juncture, the Orange County Department of Education is advising us to not recognize that, and the reason is it has not been quantified, and we do not know, nor can anyone reasonably tell us when we would expect to receive that, and if we do receive it, how much of it is going to come through. I'm sure the state will have some process they will go through to determine how to divvy that up, and there's concerns that it may not all flow through completely. Just an aside note on that is that the state is still contemplating mid-year cuts. Somehow this may get figured into that process as well. We did receive additional money related to IDEA's federal special education money, and so we've incorporated that into the budget, but keep in mind that you can't use that into the general fund. It can help offset encroachment, but it is restricted to special education appropriate expenditures. There's an issue that we are in the process of working through, and it relates to ROP pass-through money. In the ARRA money that we received from the federal government, the California Department of Education then took that money and it divided it up in terms of, or identified how it would backfill cuts that they made to categorical programs. But if you recall, we had categorical programs in three tiers, and those that were in tier three, we could use that flexibility to however we really wanted, almost like it was general fund dollars. And so we had figured to use all of the tier three funds as just general fund unrestricted dollars. But the issue here is we have a separate ROP program. Some districts have an ROP within their district. Ours is a separate JPA. And so Dr. Bogart, when the federal money then came through, gave me a call and said, where is my money? So we've been working on that issue with ROP, and we plan to bring that to the board for discussion and action on October 13th. But what I wanted to let you know is we have accounted for that in case that entire amount needs to be passed through. We have accounted for that within our budget, so we're covering that as we're working through the problem that's before us. Just a point to clarify is that while CDE identified the money to backfill the cuts made in the categorical programs, it does not require that it be spent in any specific way or that it be backfilled into any specific program. Okay, here's how we address the shortfall of the $7.8 million. And the very first line up there, I would just like to make a comment and express that the pain and the difficulty and the challenge that we went through last year, and as you recall, as we looked at all of the cuts and the spending freeze and holding the line and the categorical sweeps, was a painful process, and we wrestled with it as a district, and I know the board did as well. That $3 million is what was left at the end of the year as a result of all of that, and we were able to sweep that balance to help solve this problem. So I wanted to just commend not only the board, but the staff and everybody for buckling down and tightening up. It paid off. That's a huge bite out of that $7.8 million that didn't become truly visible until the books were closed. So I wanted to just make a note of acknowledging that was hard work that we deliberately undertook, and it paid off. Our TRAN sold today did very well in our TRAN sale, and we anticipate, as I put this together earlier, late last week, we were anticipating about $450,000 in additional revenue out of our tax revenue anticipation note. We think that's going to be a little bit higher than that even today now that the TRAN was priced and sold. But for right now, we're going to hold that at about $450,000. With the adoption of the budget, some additional flexibility was provided for. more that wasn't provided initially, and that was flexibility within adult education and deferred maintenance. If you recall, the question was asked several times, well, can't we take that deferred maintenance, the adult education balance and just pull that into the general fund? And the way that the original flexibility had been worded, that was not possible. It was additional flexibility was provided for. So what we're proposing is that we pull those revenues down out of adult ed that we can in that ending balance, as well as deferred maintenance, realizing there's a cost. There's an impact to those programs when you pull that money out of there. With deferred maintenance, it's going to mean that there will be less projects that will get funded. There will be less money available to do major maintenance, such as painting, carpet, plumbing, roofing, those types of large-ticket items. The thought here is that if we can pull those balances down, we can borrow from them. When we get the ARRA money, then we can pay that back with whatever ARRA funds we ended up getting. We had some miscellaneous adjustments that we were able to pick up about $460,000. And then as you look at the ending balance over and above the 2%, there was about $600,000 resting there after the books were closed. And so we're proposing to sweep all of those, capture all of that money. And when you put it together, it comes up to about 8.3. And then if we end up having to pay the ROP money past that through, if that ends up coming to fruition, we've accounted for that there, and we've been able to fill that gap of the $7.8 million. Okay. Now, this ties into this multiple year, the multiple year sheet you have, which is the recap as well as a look ahead. And I just wanted to kind of give you a picture of where we're going. And these are amounts that ended up in the bottom line over and above the 2% required reserve. So this is the money that we have available beyond what we're required to keep in accounts. So in 08-09, we ended up at about $11,000, not very much. There you look at 9-10, we're $7.8 million. That hole we had to fill, we filled that, so we end up basically with filling the hole, and as the books exist on paper, about $5,600. As we look into 10-11, and we've talked about this number before, Trustee Palazzo mentioned it this evening, we're looking at a cut of $25 million in 10-11. It's approximately the same as where we were when we were looking at adopting the budget in June. And then again in 11-12, $29.4 million. Now, just to make sure, to clarify and make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about here, is that if we make the $25 million in cuts in 10-11 and they're ongoing cuts, we only make $4.3 million in 11-12. That's because that $25 million cut carries to the next year. If we, for example, say we made a $25 million one-time cut, we're going to have to come back the next year and make another $29 million cut. So if you make the $25 million in 10-11, it carries forward, and you're only looking at about $4.3 million, an additional cut in 11-12. Now, I ran out of room to put footnotes on here. But there could be some additional footnotes. One of them would be, keep in mind the state has provided flexibility with class size reduction and with categorical programs. Those begin to roll off in 11-12. So we don't know what the state is going to do with respect to those programs. If those roll off, these numbers could go either way in a heartbeat. Again, we're still living within this ambiguity and trying to get a snapshot of where we are today in a picture that's been moving across the budget year. A couple of things that are, I think, worth mentioning that are yet to be quantified that have not been put into the budget that we intend to get quantified as we can and put into the budget by first interim, which will be coming to you in December, is enrollment at P2, which is what we're funded off of in April, 52,170 students. We had budgeted enrollment at 52,203. That's always an estimate in your assumption. So a growth of 33. We had incorporated the rest of the enrollment into that we were figuring about 100 growth, but that got incorporated into last year, and so we really only carried forward with 33. Current enrollment as of last week, when the kids are showing up now, first week of school, 52,414. But what tends to happen between the beginning of the year and P2 is you tend to drop. So at this point, we're very hesitant to revise enrollment up or to make an adjustment to it. I would like to hold firm on our our enrollment projection and take a hard look at that as we move forward and get a little bit better clarity. The other thing that has yet to be quantified within our budget is we have some position laps. We have a number of positions that have been vacant for a while, and we've been waiting on the reorganization plan that we're planning to bring forward to you before we pull those all completely out of the budget and make changes related to the reorganization plan. So there most likely will be savings within that, and that has not been recognized in it because the board has not taken action on those particular items yet. Textbook adoption, I think you may have heard that there was a waiver of the requirements to do the textbook adoption. We've budgeted about $2 million per year for textbook adoption over the next several years. Not all of that would necessarily be available because you have to replace some books and do book repairs, etc. But we haven't yet figured out exactly how that's going to play out. What we were thinking and looking at was evaluating those adoptions on a case-by-case basis. So until we're able to come up with a definitive plan, we had not budgeted that money in. Health insurance savings cost, we're in the process of renewing our health insurance. We believe there will be some savings there as well. It hasn't been quantified in a final hard quote, but we believe that some of those savings will come forward, and then we'll identify those and incorporate those at first interim. This next slide was just simply an attempt to kind of put into perspective the big talking points that we have here on the budget. If we're looking at a $25 million reduction in 10-11, and we have a $379 million budget, that's 6.7%, roughly, of what that budget is. Just to put it in perspective, October payroll for this year is $31 million. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but it has been suggested, and there's flexibility within our budgeting ability this year to drop into our 2%. Well, our 2% reserve is $7.6 million, not a whole lot. And if you take a look at what's in that reserve, it isn't really enough to cover but just about a week's worth of payroll. And so while we're allowed to dip into that reserve, it's not something I would encourage us to do because you have to pay it back in the fiscal year that you dip into it. So what we're I just wanted to point that out because that has come up. You may have heard it in the news that you're able to tap that, but it's really, I think, a false sense of security when it's not a whole lot of money compared to what a monthly payroll is. And the reason why we're here to really put this in perspective, why we're wrestling with this to the degree we are, is that we're receiving $58 million less in state revenue limit funding than what we're entitled to statutorily in COLA. That's about $1,100 per student. That's why this has been so difficult, is because of that reduction in revenue over the last several years. So 85% of our payroll, or 85% of our expenditures comprise payroll. We're a people business. That's why it's difficult to make cuts in this type of an organization without having it affect somebody's wallet. So where are we today and where are we headed? Well, mid-year cuts, we're not sure where that's going to go. The state could end up cutting us another approximately $21 per ADA, still meet their required maintenance of effort and not jeopardize their federal funds, the second round of the federal ARRA money. What they do with that, I don't know. There could be a possibility that they could recalculate it in an even different way and take a greater cut. All we know at this point is just simply hearsay, and so I don't know sitting here tonight when or if, but I think we probably will have. So here's our next steps. What we're proposing to do would be to begin to quantify or to begin to identify possibilities for the $25 million and bring those to the board on October 13th, and then begin to walk that through the process through November and on into December, when a decision would need to be made by first interim to identify those really in a big draft form. There's always refinement that would take place as you move into the spring as the budget numbers are quantified, but in order to meet our fiscal solvency requirements, the OCDE is requesting that we have all of that taken care of by first interim, which would certainly help as we move forward. So with that, are there any questions on this portion of the presentation?
Trustee Bryson.
Yes, go back to the health insurance cost savings.
Today I was in, well, for the past 2 days, and I will be in tomorrow morning also, symposiums that cover every aspect of the fiscal situation of the state. And today I was in several that are involved in school financing specifically. One of the speakers was the CFO of San Diego District, which I believe is the second largest in the state after an L.A. And he was talking about the fact that they are now definitively going to be looking at the copay as a vehicle to ease the situation they're in, because they're fine, they haven't done a lot of the, they're just getting into a lot of the things that we've already been doing. And he said that they were looking to move their, all of their 85% from $5 copay to $20 copay. And so these are things that it was very interesting to hear from another school district and would have bearing if we do consider these things moving forward. Is that correct?
That is correct. Those conversations are taking place, but over and above that, there's some hard number savings for health insurance. I just don't have those quantified yet.
Right. No, I don't need those now, but I'm just saying that these are all things that we can consider moving forward.
And we are. We are having those conversations.
Because San Diego said that they definitely were in the middle of that conversation as a district and felt that that was going to be a very cost-effective.
We are as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All of the handouts this evening are available on the web, and the minor revisions, the handouts will be swapped out tomorrow morning at some point, so the most current ones will be up and available. What I want to do now is have Christopher Pittman address just some items within the unaudited actuals that relate to the action you're going to be taking. So I'm going to hand that over to Chris and let him go.
Madam President and trustees, the handout that you have on the furthest left-hand column is the unaudited actuals, which is what I'm going to be covering. Within that, that is an updated, revised version of the estimated actuals that you saw and reviewed and approved at the June board meeting. Within the unaudited actuals, there's three major revisions to the estimated actuals that you've already seen, two of which occur in Fund 1, one of which occur in Fund 68. Fund 68, if you don't know readily, that's our workers' comp self-insurance fund. But to review the two changes that are significant within Fund 1, the first is in the revenue limit and state revenue, which accounts for a change of about $11.6 million. This is a pretty big number, but that change is primarily due to an increase of approximately $253 that the state apportioned to us at the last minute within the fiscal year, 08-09, but then promptly took away through a cut at the beginning of 9-10 and took away an additional amount on top of that. So while our ending balance technically at the end of 08-09 increased by $11.6 million through additional revenue, that money was taken right off the table to begin with for the 09-10 fiscal year. So that while it looks like it's a big number that we received, we really netted zero.
And less than zero.
Less than zero. They
took more than they gave.
Exactly. And the second major addition to the revenue there was within the federal one-time funding, within the state fiscal stabilization money, and also the IDEA. During 08-09, we were approved and received the first round of state fiscal stabilization money, which was quantified at approximately $17 million for CUSD. We were budgeting and approved for approximately $10 million of that first round of funding. The state released to us an additional approximately $7 million, so the full first round funding, by June 30th. We had no way of spending it, no way of having a plan in place for it, so that actually carried forward into our beginning balance for 9-10. An additional amount to that was also the IDEA money. We were able to realize approximately $2 million of the total IDEA apportionment during 08-09. So we were able to allocate some expenditures during 08-09 towards that $2 million revenue that we recognized. As far as the adjustment to Fund 68, which again is the Workers' Comp Self-Insurance Fund, we made an adjustment of approximately $4.45 million, which is on the slide rounded up to $4.5 million. That is in regards to an audit restatement. If you recall, we engaged with a new audit firm, Vavrinec, Trine & Day, during the 2008-2009 fiscal year. They, during their audit review and their look through of our documents and the closing of our fiscal year, they made a recommendation that we restate how we account for our workers' comp liability. Our previous audit firm suggested that we go with what the actual outstanding claims were. VTD, their viewpoint is that we needed to go with what the actuarial liability based on the actuarial study was. That amount is approximately $6 million. We had accounted for a portion of that total actuarial amount through our outstanding claims, but the difference between the actuarial liability, that's a sort of a paper number, it's based on calculations by what a third party does for us, and the actual amount that we had funded was that approximately $4.5 million. We were able to fund that through about $3.8 million in insurance reserve that we had on hand within the insurance funds, but we also did have to make a transfer from the general fund of a little more than $650,000 to cover the full balance. So those are the three main points within the unaudited actuals that are a significant change from the estimated actuals that you've seen previously. At the end of the day, we're still looking at the 2% reserve minimum that we need to maintain. When we made all those changes and accounted for all of the ending activity, we still were able to arrive at the $7.8 million statutorily required reserve, which is a good thing. But if you have any questions, we are happy to respond to the business.
Trustee Bryson?
I must agree with Ron and with you that it is a very good thing to maintain that 2% reserve and to never look at that as a source of anything, because that is the stabilizing force in our budget. And that is the basis of stability for our students. And in fact, to dip into that would be extremely irresponsible, more now than ever. In this same conference, the state treasurer, Bill Lockyer, stated something that we have been discussing in Treasurer Street's office, that we believe that the worst is way yet to come. Probably in February there will be a complete, very, very difficult circumstances then, because a lot of things that I won't go into come to bear in the state. And we had better be very cautious, very conservative, and very careful as to how we proceed.
Well said. Thus, our reserve should actually be increased from 2% to perhaps 2.5.
Well, I think that's a good conversation that I think we need to have over the next several months or year, whenever, is that what is an appropriate amount of reserve to try to build to. Other issues that are going to come to bear as well as our post-employment retirement benefits and how we plan to fund those. That's an actuarial study as well. There are a number of pressing issues that relate to reserves and balances that kind of get pushed by the wayside when you're in these extremely difficult financial times. But as we come out of it, I think, President Adonisio, you have a very good point, is that I think that it would be a good conversation to have and to establish a policy and then a process by which we hope to build those reserves up so that the next time we go through this, we're not scraping the bottom of the barrel, but we have a little bit of a cushion to move through. What an appropriate level is would be up to the board in a conversation.
Okay. Are you finished?
Yes, thank you.
I can move approval of the financial statements and approval of the resolution.
Is this a resolution? This is a resolution. We need a roll call.
Trustee Brick?
Yes.
Trustee Bryson?
Yes.
Trustee Palazzo?
Yes.
Trustee Christensen?
Yes.
Student advisor Sam Alakani?
Yes.
Trustee Lopez Maddox?
Aye.
Trustee Winston?
Yes.
Trustee Adonisio?
Aye. The motion carries 7-0. Item number 33, maintenance and operation. This is an information discussion item.
Yeah, I'd like to give a brief introduction if
yes.
I could. With me here this evening for this is John Forney, our Director of Construction. And one of the next items in the agenda we're going to be talking about, WLC is going to presenting the Facilities Master Plan. And just to I would like to kind of frame the discussion. If you look at facilities and maintenance within the district, I think it can be broken into three really broad categories. Is you have capital projects, which are at that upper level that require some sort of outside funding or financing. You don't typically generate that within district. An example would be building a multipurpose room or adding relocatable classrooms or doing a major modernization or remodel at a school. As kind of you move down through those three segments, then I think the next big group would be a deferred maintenance. And deferred maintenance is an actual term that's used at the state to describe those types of projects that you do that are more on a long-term basis. And there's an actual program, the deferred maintenance program, and it's designed to do replacements of carpet, painting, lighting systems, plumbing fixtures, asphalt repair, HVAC units. Now, some of your capital projects drift into that second category, and then as we move on through the category down into your typical daily maintenance and repairs, like the outlet in the wall doesn't work, or the switch needs to be fixed, or the sink broke and you have to replace the sink. There's some overlap in all of that. But what we're trying to do this evening is give you an idea of kind of those big broad categories. Bob and his team will be discussing those big capital issues. What John has done is put together two lists. One list of items that was accomplished over the summer that included those items that fall in between little tiny repair and deferred type maintenance as well as deferred maintenance. And then he's got another list of the same type of items that we're planning to accomplish over this fiscal year. So without taking away any of his thunder, I'll let him address those and go from there.
Good evening. The first list, which is our summer project list that maintenance and operations construction did, is a list of projects that came about through either work orders or principals' concerns, but it was pretty much driven on safety, and also there's a lot of preventive maintenance here, generators, cooling towers and whatnot, and also a lot of carpet replacements due to indoor air quality safety issues. So what I'd like to do is just keep the board and keep people informed of exactly what we're doing, not just once a year, but often. So when you're asked or you get an email or a phone call, you're like, oh, yeah, we know about that. We're going to address that. And I think that would help with a lot of people coming to you guys. The second list that we put together, it's some what we call like our red hots that we're aware of, we know of. In conjunction to roughly the 13,000 work orders that we get a year, we want to address these. A lot of what we do in maintenance is reactive maintenance. The
the toilet overflowed or, you know, the major pipe broke. So we're constantly reacting. But what we'd like to do is be a little more proactive. In some of the areas that we know that there's issues, we want to be able to get out there first and not just stand by and wait for that reactive type call, you know. So this is just a first glance on, you know, first run pass through, whatever we'd like to call it. And this will be changing, updated. I'd like to bring, you know, weekly updates to the board so you exactly know what's going on.
Don't overcommit there.
No.
I'll take that every Friday. Well done. We've been looking for this type of information for a while now, so
yeah.
It's very helpful to us and to you, I'm sure.
What we were trying to do was get the information into your hands and the public's hands of things we're actually doing. I mean, things are happening, and we felt, you know, maybe we ought to kind of not toot our horn, but at least explain that good things are happening out there and give you
advice
a list of those.
On the status. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any comments, Trustee Bryson?
Just to let my voice go along with the chair's voice, President Adonizio's voice, how happy we are to see this. We have waited several years, and it's a wonderful day because all of the constituents, parents, and everyone will know exactly where we are with their school site, and everyone can watch the forward motion on these things, and we very much appreciate the information, really very much.
Trustee Christensen.
Yes, I too am happy to see something like this finally presented to us. I don't notice in here any of the items like for the infrastructure that are currently out of code, out of compliance, ADA, fire and safety. This is just related to maintenance. So, I mean, those are issues, too, that need to be addressed. I don't see those here.
The bulk of those are most likely addressed within the facilities master plan. Those are more of your capital type expenditures. There's blending. There's no fine line. And as we identify those things that we believe really move into a safety issue, then we will identify those and address those as we can, as funding permits.
Okay.
I hear what you're saying.
Because some of those you almost need to do before you do your roofing or anything else, because there's lawsuits involved and anything else that can happen.
If the board or the community is aware of any items that are of any particular nature that need to be addressed, please forward those to us and we'll take a look at those.
Trustee Winston.
One quick question. We approved, and I think it was deferred, the rebuild of the Dana Hills gym floor.
Yes. I'm sorry.
What's the current timeline on that?
Currently, the project is at DSA. I just checked actually yesterday because I thought that might come up. And I'm being told we should have it out of DSA by December so that we can go forward as far as getting approval to go out to bid and award it. And the timeline, in working with Dr. Nye, the principal, we'd like to, we're shooting for a spring replacement when all the seasons are over, as far as using the gym. But over the summer, there were some real issues on the condition of the current gym floor, so we repaired those. So there's no safety issue until we can get the new floor in.
Okay, keep it moving. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Trustee Bryson.
Just a final thought on budget, a little bit of a different thought, possibly an optimistic one. As Superintendent Mahler is aware, I was the guest a week and a half ago at a special closed session with Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. I was invited by the mayor of Sacramento, and he, in many comments, which I hope to have ready today, but unfortunately they were not, but they will be given to every member of the board, and they will be presented to the public to take a look at his comments. In the structure of his comments, he did reference numbers of $4 and $6 billion, which will be coming towards California, and how that's going to come in and whether we will be able to access any of that money. We have no idea at this time, but he was very specific in his numbers. And I will certainly, anything I can get, any information I can get to relay to Ron and the board on the status of those numbers and how we can put in for portions of those numbers, I will do so as quickly as possible. His comments were, in many, many cases, extremely hopeful and optimistic, and
I think, exciting in some cases because his vision with the president for education looks pretty sound. And so I will make sure that those are relayed to you as soon as possible. Of course, we won't all agree on everything, but I will say fundamentally and overall, I found it to be a vastly optimistic conversation for many reasons, and one of them being financial, and the other reasons you'll see when I release the notes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Well done. Thank you for the report. We'll move on now to item number 34, another discussion information item, Division of the State Architect report.
Yes, at the request of the board, you'd like to see monthly discussions on the update with DSA. Last time I reported this in July, I believe, not much had changed, but I did some research. I called up the San Diego Division of Architects office for some status on what's going on with at least the stuff that we've submitted paperwork-wise, and I found out that the DSA statewide is taking now 3 furlough Fridays, so they're having issues with, you know, staff. They're not sending as much stuff out to consultants. They're trying to do more in-house, and basically what DSA is calling it is their priorities that are with, they call shovel-ready projects, which is projects that are fully funded, that are ready to go, because they want to, their take because they want to stimulate the economy and get things going. So with that said, I did have, you know, update this, and I'm happy to report that we got a closeout with certification, and since this went to publication, I received another one. So we've got 2 more. And also, we've identified staff with the architect, PJHM, that there's some modernizations that weren't completed fully. And so we've identified the scope of work. Now we just need to find out what will it cost, what will DSA say, okay, that's okay, you don't have to do. So I'll be bringing those updates forward, as well as a lot of the paperwork still is at DSA. And they said they'll get to it when they get to it.
Thank you. Any other comments? Trustee Christensen?
I'd like to emphasize that on these, that you actually pursue DSA on a lot of different levels. I work with every agency there is, cities, government, as far as county, state, and federal, all the time. And I know that you always get excuses from them. There's a procedure that they want to follow, and if you just are quiet and you're not the squeaky wheel, you really just get put in the system, and it's hard to get spit back out of that system. I mean, I would encourage you to actually follow up, talk to people, find the next level of people to talk to, the next level, and become that squeaky wheel, because some of these items we can't just sit around and wait for them to give us a resolution on for months and months down the line. And it seems to be in all levels in government. You can push them, and they'll take care of you just to get rid of you. So I'd kind of encourage you to go along that route.
And I've actually have done that. I have gone to San Diego and met with Craig Rush, who's in charge of the San Diego division where all our stuff is at. And, you know, they're just saying, we're doing the best we can. And, yeah, and so I you know, I take your advice and I keep pushing because this is important to get closed out. I recognize that.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Item number 35, Facilities Master Plan. Discussion information, Mr. Libs.
Yes, I'm going to ask Bob Hensley and Betty Sable to come up, and they'll be presenting the long-range facility or the facilities master plan. Like I said earlier in my comments, is this is really the trying to capture the bigger capital picture of what's out there. But they have a presentation ready to go, and they'll dig into it. I'm going to help them get set up. Madam President, might we take a 5-minute
yes.
break so we can get this set up? He has to restart his computer.
Let's take a 5-minute recess. Thank you. Are we ready to reconvene?
We are ready to proceed.
The board is reconvening. Thank you.
I will turn it over
Mr.
to
Libs.
I will turn it over to Mr. Hensley.
Thank you, Ron. Dr. Mahler, President at Adesanyisio and Board, it's a pleasure to be here tonight and have a chance to present to you the facility's master plan. My name is Bob Hensley. I'm Principal Architect with WLC Architects, and with me is Betty Sable, the key architect that's been working with me throughout the entire process. What we've provided the Board tonight is there's an executive summary that you have, and contained in there is the PowerPoint presentation that we're going to go through, so you can kind of flip through that and make notes if you'd like. What I'd like to do is just go through the PowerPoint presentation. We're intending to kind of explain the overall process to highlight what's contained within the facility's master plan, and then we'll be open for any questions or comments that you would have following that. Okay?
Thank you.
The presentation will consist of first talking a little bit about the facility's master plan in terms of the overall scope. We'll talk about the documentation process, equity of facilities. That was one key element that we were looking into in terms of how do we have equity between facilities that range from nearly new to 80 years old. It's very difficult sometimes, but I think we've approached it in a way that gives you an idea of how you can look at the facilities in that regard. Code compliance issues that you talked about just a few moments ago, we've covered a lot of that. Demographic review, the campus master plans. We've identified a master plan for every campus that includes a cost estimate and a summary of all the improvements that have been identified throughout the planning process. We've identified some of the projects in terms of prioritizing what seems to be, in our opinion, the most urgent needs. And then lastly, talk about the deliverables of what we're actually turning over to the district. And we want to be sure that what we're providing you with is something that's usable for the district and isn't just something that's going to sit on a shelf, although there's a lot of books there to sit on a shelf, and we'll go over that in a few minutes. The facility's master plan. The first step in the documentation was for us to get out there and walk the sites so we could understand exactly what was going on with the facilities. We were adding to what had been previously done, a needs assessment, by not only identifying what the needs were, but quantifying the needs, coming up with some square footage, lineal footage, whatever the common denominator was, and then applying a cost to that so that we could come up with some way of describing to you what's the extent of the improvements, not just talking about an improvement in general. We looked at minimum improvements and repairs based on our own visit, but as well as incorporating the deferred maintenance plan. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't an overlap, or we wanted to make sure that we weren't doing two different things, that we were identifying things that were also being identified by the district. So we included and incorporated the deferred maintenance into the overall scope of what we defined. We compared schools against what we call state standards in terms of equity of facilities, and that's really looking at the State Department of Education recommended standards and saying, well, what if you built that elementary school today? What should it have? And then we would look at what you did have and make those comparisons. And again, we understand if a school was built back in the 70s, the standards were different in the 70s. So it takes a little bit of interpolating between those, but we're trying to just give you a measuring stick to say if an elementary school should have a library media center of a certain size for a certain number of students, that should probably apply across the board. So it's just one way of looking at the facility. We reviewed each site for the Division of State Architects compliance, and I think John Forney, he discussed some of that, and really it's kind of the same topic, but it's looking more of a global issue across the district. We reviewed the campuses for capacity compared to state standards and historical use. The state will recommend a certain number of students based on a certain amount of acreage, and I know sometimes that doesn't always work out. Some of your school sites are kind of small for high school sites. I think Dana Hills is fairly small in terms of the number of students. So we're looking at those to make some recommendations in terms of limiting the amount of building that could be done on certain sites based on those types of issues. Meetings with the district administration and staff, we were discussing the findings as we were moving through the process. We were suggesting some renovations and additions and testing those as we were talking to staff members just to see what seemed to be appropriate for each site. And then we developed a master plan that was intended to maximize the potential use of each site so that in the end, if money wasn't a concern, and I know it is a concern from all the discussions tonight, you know, what would you do? What would be the optimum design for each of your campuses? So that's kind of what we're trying to present. We prepared a detailed cost estimate based on the planned improvements, and we prioritized these, also looking at what state funding is available. I think that always comes into play, is that part of the motivation is when there's state money available, and what does it take for the district to pursue that money, and how can that be integrated into the overall master plan. We started the process by having aerial photographs taken of each campus, and that was simply because the district really didn't have a good documentation in place that showed them not only what your existing permanent buildings were, but where all the relocatables went, because over the years they've been placed, and so this gave us a snapshot of what was there. And I know the district, John has mentioned that this has been very usable in terms of just as a talking tool when you meet to decide what you need to do for each of the campuses. This next section of documentation was we walked every campus. We took nearly 200 photos of each campus. So if they say a photo is worth 1,000 words, we took over 10,000 photographs of your campuses and trying to document all the things that we thought needed to be documented and defined. And I need to say this, don't be afraid of the photographs or feel like that they're making the district appear like they're in a bad scrape. I've visited hundreds of schools over the years, and the reality is, when you are looking at facilities that range from 80 years old up to new, you're going to see a lot of things out there, and with deferred maintenance being minimal, things can get away from you. So our intent is not to put the district in a bad light in terms of facilities. It's just to simply say these are the things that are out there. These are the things that need to be addressed, and as you move forward, you're aware of them. Oh, well, let me go back because I didn't even talk about this one. The first one was site conditions. We looked at issues like ADA. Anywhere where you have a ramp that maybe isn't in compliance with ADA, we would identify that and include that within the estimate. I thought this was a nice note. Please do not turn off the lights. They share the classroom next door. And this has happened. I think you have 9 campuses that were designed probably in the 70s time period when there was open campus or open school design was kind of an educational concept. Since then, we've moved away from that, and most of those have been closed off into individual classrooms. The problem is there was never the funding or the money to really do that in a way that was complete. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done going back into some of those older facilities and developing those classrooms in a more permanent solution. Issues of roof conditions. It's not just a matter of sweeping off and cleaning a roof. Some of the older roofs have settled, so you have low spots that need to be dealt with in the repair so that the roofs won't deteriorate any worse. You have some teacher-installed wiring, I'd say, in some cases, were just, low-voltage wiring or plugs, and it's not a big deal, but it's not per code, so those things do need to be addressed. You have HVAC units, and I know, John, we were talking about this. These are at Elisa Nagel High School, and some of them have already been replaced, and they're planning on replacing them all when the funds are available, and this is just mostly from corrosion, the sea air. We have plumbing situations. We have ADA accessibility situations under countertops. We ran into a few structural issues. This is San Clemente High School, one of the few areas that really we needed to bring the structural engineer out to take a look. This isn't a failure condition, but it's certainly an area that needs to have a few beams replaced, and so we brought that to the district's attention so it could be addressed. In defining the improvements, we broke it down into a few categories. WLC Architects focused a lot on the site work, building interiors, exteriors, ADA compliance, maintenance repairs, roofing, building finishes, and other general topics. Our engineers came in and evaluated the electrical systems, fire alarm systems, low voltage, HVAC systems, plumbing, and selective structural issues when there was something of note that needed to be reviewed. In doing so, we tabulated a cost estimate format that we used for every campus. And what I'd like to do is kind of break out of the PowerPoint for a second and show you something on one of the spreadsheets. This is Castile Elementary School. And basically what we did was each of the cost estimates are broken into a few major categories. We have site work as a category, right up in here, and if I pan down the page, it goes to exteriors of this 200 category, interiors is 300, roof, electrical systems, and just broken into various categories. And what we tried to do to tie this back together so that it made some sense with the photographs and not have to go through all the photographs is we embedded many of the photographs into the topic. So if you go to the line item that's highlighted here, demo existing paving, you can click on the item and go right to the photographs that are involved here. And for some reason, this one's coming up. It's not fitting in the screen right. And the same with other areas like play surfaces. If you're looking at play surfaces, you can simply go and see, well, where was that? Well, here are the play surfaces. There's sand in the kindergarten play area, which isn't permitted by code. So it gives you a visual connected to the cost estimate so that when somebody else is looking at the estimate, they have a way to kind of quantify what the topic was. And that's pretty much been done for every campus. And in addition to doing that for every campus, we've also tabulated that by family so that we have each of the families listing the totals that go with every school within that family. The next topic is really looking at the equity of facilities. I guess one major thing that I was thinking about when I was going through this is it's amazing to look at the district's growth over the years. I mean, you grew almost two facilities or two campuses a year for many years. And I think what I see, I guess my interpretation is that most of the energy and the focus was opening the doors of that new school for the next year and bringing more classrooms on board to accommodate the students. It's very difficult within the facility departments, whatever you have at that point in time, to do much more than that. And I think that's what you kind of see as you look at the older facilities, and they need a little bit more work because a lot of the attention has been on just kind of day-to-day growth. But now that things have slowed down, in a way it's a good opportunity. It allows you to kind of reflect and see what you have and see what needs to be done to bring some of the other facilities up to speed. When we compare State Department of Education standards to the facilities, we see the obvious that older campuses require more improvements. We see that many of the relocatable classrooms have really kind of exceeded their useful lifespan, and there needs to be some consideration of how do you remove those. I guess on the positive note, when we get to funding, you have eligibility. On the negative note, you need to have money to match the state's eligibility to tap into it. So minimal essential facilities, I'll talk about in a minute. Equity in terms of educational opportunity, those are tied together. I mean, you're looking to have facilities that have comparable educational environments at each campus, and that's what we're trying to show in the master plans. Facility surveys were broken down into four major topics, the one being minimal essential facilities. And again, that's just simply looking at each school site. Take, for example, a middle school. The Department of Ed would recommend that all middle schools have a gymnasium. That's just a part of the educational program. You don't have that here. So we're showing that on most of your middle schools that we're recommending that they should have a gymnasium just to meet the standards. It's a lot of money, so it's, you know, you have to prioritize what you can do, but we're just showing you what the recommendations would be. We look at the site adequacy in terms of acreage. Restroom fixture count was a major topic. Looking at that district-wide, it's amazing, you know, how much work needs to be done, and it's overwhelming in some extents when you look at the total plan. Parking and student drop-off areas and circulation was another consideration. To just give you a flavor of a few of the things that we looked at each of the campuses, regarding this issue of equity, was providing adequate classroom space. This goes back to one of the facilities that were built and originally as an open plan, is there needs to be something done to accommodate those classrooms so that they're the proper size over time, and probably more importantly address acoustical issues, lighting issues, HVAC issues, and problems that exist because there was never really a major renovation done. It was more like partitions were put up so that the classrooms could be isolated. contemplated but not fully thought through. Some of the equity issues I think you're addressing now with the performing arts theaters for Capistrano Valley and Dana Hills, that's moving them in that direction of having adequate facilities. Now, the board passed a resolution a while back that all your future facilities would address issues of sustainable design, and we've incorporated that in the performing arts theaters, and we're including that in our content of our report just so that it's there for everyone to recognize that the new facility should address energy conservation, quality of materials for indoor air quality, water conservation, and waste management. This is what I mentioned earlier, providing gymnasiums at the middle and K-8 facilities. We've shown that on the facilities master plan. This is just the aerial photo kind of giving you the idea of how we were addressing those. Equity of facilities in terms of administrative office spaces. A lot of the older facilities were designed for maybe 400 students, and as they've grown, the administration buildings don't grow typically. They just kind of use the space that they have. So we're looking back again and making some recommendations on the size of administrative space as well as the other support spaces. Library media center is another key area. A lot of the older schools that I used to see built in the 50s and 60s, it was typically a classroom space was your library media center. Things changed when the computers were integrated and you had more of a media center focused than just the library. And typically now the recommendation, I believe, is about, I don't know, about 2,500.
For
a typical elementary school. I'm just trying to think of what.
For library?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of library media center. It's somewhere around 2,500, 3,000 square feet, typically for an elementary school, which is quite a bit more than a standard classroom. Code compliance, Americans with Disabilities Act. I think this is an issue of liability for the district, so I think it kind of has to sit on the top of the list. As you look at door hardware throughout the district, there's issues. There's path of travel of ramps that have been installed and don't quite comply. Parking stalls that don't have proper access from the building, path of travel, many restroom facilities. And it's not because they're designed incorrectly. They were designed correctly at the time they were built. It's just they no longer comply. Access to all work areas, and even signage, needing to have signage with Braille indication on it as well as regular signage. So these are all things that may seem kind of minor and they fall to the bottom of a list, but we've seen districts, and we've seen not just districts but municipalities that get into legal issues because things haven't been brought up to code. So it's important to be aware of the issues. Division of State Architect, you talked a lot about that earlier, and I think it's important to note that progress has been made because when we first came on board, I think we identified over 60 projects that didn't comply, and now you're somewhere in the 40s range. So that's definitely improvement. And I think to note is that in addition to the liability, it will become a roadblock to you down the road that when you want to do work at a school site, you'll suddenly find that the Division of State Architect won't accept your plans because previous work hasn't been completed on the site. So there's a couple of motivations for mopping those things up and making sure that they get completed. Capistrano Valley High School, we ran into one of the issues in the Performing Arts Theater. We had used the ADA access that we thought was in the parking lot based on a previous plan, but when we walked the site, the work had never been done. So we included it in the Capistrano Theater, and now you can take it off your list. So there's ways that you can diminish the list of incomplete projects by incorporating the scope into other smaller projects. Fire safety, local and state agencies. Fire access is really reviewed by your local fire marshal as well as the state fire marshal, and there are some issues that we noted at some of your school sites. There's basically 21 of your school sites needs to have some kind of improvements, and it's not a major issue. It's just a matter of the fire access road doesn't go back quite as far as it should to give you full coverage of all the buildings that exist. We have that in the master plan, so you can see what needs to be done. when you talk about funding sources, we look at funding typically as OPSC, or the Office of Public School Construction is the major entity that provides funding for new schools. You have eligibility for about $197 million in state funding. New construction funding is about exhausted right now, so I don't think there wouldn't be likely that you would tap into any of that. They had talked about having a bond on the ballot in 2010, but that's kind of fallen off the discussion. I think it's now going to be 2012, likely another bond. So, but even though that seems like a long ways away, there's a long path to go before you get to the point of acquiring the money anyway, so it's still something to be definitely thinking about. But it does require the district to come up with a match. So how do you come up with a match? There's ways that communities do that. With the economy that we have right now, it's very difficult to imagine much going on in terms of local bonds, but there's ways to try to accommodate for that. I think the one area that's really accessible for the district, if there was a way to come up with matching money for this, is modernization. There's still a few billion dollars left in the modernization program. They've been freezing their money on and off, and it may be a little bit while longer, but I think eventually that money will flow to the school districts that have the ability to match. So I think as we move forward with the presentation, I think there's some areas that you might want to try to tap into that funding to solve some of your ADA issues and your code compliance issues, as well as some of the renovation work. The categories that we defined back in the cost estimate kind of show up like this. We're showing about $17 million in DSA code issues. That's district-wide. About $11.7 million in general site work, renovation work at $57 million, modernization around $55 million, minimal essential facilities in terms of core facilities at about $196 million, and replacing their portables at $426. So it's a huge amount. I realize that, but that's what the numbers come to. And deferred maintenance at around $56 million. If you look at the matching money, it flows into the two categories, the state modernization and replacement of relocatables. And mainly the relocatable replacement is because it has to do with students.
Thank you. We do have a trustee question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam President. This is just goes to the heart of the money that I heard the Secretary of Education speak about. If there is a stream, and I do believe that there was some mention of a particular stream that will have to do with revitalizing older schools, so forth and so on. If there is such a federal stream, okay, that would alleviate some of this from the state funding. Is that not correct?
I'm not sure exactly how they would approach that, because things have been changing so much. All the things that I knew were normal are no longer normal. I mean, the money that flows in that's supposed to go to a program suddenly goes somewhere else. So I would suspect that I would be hopeful that if the federal money came in, it would simply move the state program forward the way that it's always supposed to be going forward.
That's an interesting point, but we need to keep our eye on that ball, that's for sure.
As far as prioritizing, our recommendation is that the DSA code compliance and deferred maintenance are probably the two biggest issues, because code compliance carries with it the liability. Deferred maintenance carries with it deterioration of facilities even further if those things aren't taken care of. So we kind of see those as being really important issues, and everything else on the list is really kind of a selection of what do you want to see happen first. Because the money flows into these other categories, there is the ability to take money, or there is the ability to fold code compliance and deferred maintenance issues into the modernization of your projects. So the way I would look at it is you could tap into the $33 million if you had the ability to match that with the $20-some million to take care of some of those issues. And the new construction will remain there, and even though it seems like a long ways off, in 2012, if they pass a bond, that would be available money as well. The demographic review was fairly simple, because we just looked at what had been done back in 2007, and it showed some pretty steep growth curve for the early years. And I'm just going to get to the graph real quick, but it shows you kind of leveling out around 2003, 2004, and then continuing to increase. I think this year is even a surprise, showing about 400 students or whatever the number was. It's projected going forward, if you just use your cohort projection, projections, you know, it's going to show some growth. It's hard to predict because we don't know when the economy is going to turn and they start building houses again. But I think in terms of facilities, it gives you a breather. It gives you a chance to kind of decide what you want to do before it hits you and not just be in a total reactive mode. I'm going to let Betty take over here and talk a little bit about how we develop the actual master plans for each of the campuses.
Oh, good evening, everyone. I'd like to share with you the campus master plan. This is an example, just one, that we will be sharing with you, one for each family as we've selected just randomly for this presentation. But we developed these master plans for 53 of the campuses surveyed. So they're all in the same format. And as Bob explained, we reviewed for each one of them the minimum essential facilities, fire access for every site. We did toilet counts for every single one of your school sites. And we took the information that was provided by the California Department of Education, Office of your local fire authority here in Orange County, as well as the comments that were listed previously in the facility assessment reports and comments from the administrators that were current when we did our assessment and district staff. All of that information was pulled together to develop these campus master plans and develop a game plan for each one of the plans. And I'd just like to go through with you how they are organized. First of all, each one of the plans is given the name, of course. In this case, we're looking at Don Juan Avila Elementary and Middle School. There's a legend that is provided for each of the plans that gives you an indication of what the materials are that are listed on the plan. For example, if you're looking at new construction, you will see that it is in the orange color, and a remodel color would be a yellow. So it would be easier to identify some of the improvements that are being proposed. And then towards the bottom there, the letters will give you an indication as to the building type on the graphic portion of the campus master plan. Below, you will see a list of numbers that will indicate the improvements that are needed. Again, compiling all the information and being guided by all these different agencies and comments, these are the improvements that are being proposed. And what we'd like to do is highlight some of them. For example, for Don Juan Avila Elementary School, this was a campus that was built during the period when the state program required 30% of classrooms to be portable. So you have this particular school that has the yellow that is indicated there is basically a portable, and the floor is a wood floor. And as has been mentioned before, in the portables you get indoor environmental quality issues. So in this case, we're highlighting that we're proposing to replace the wood floor system with a more substantial concrete slab for these type of classrooms. Here we have Crown Valley Elementary School, and as you can see, it's in the same format. And what we'd like to highlight here, as Bob touched on and as I mentioned, is that we set out to resolve the issues that were fire access issues and ADA issues. And this particular campus, as you will note in your executive summary, it's one of the ones that is listed at the very top for needing coverage. And basically what has happened over the years as the schools develop, there is play equipment that is located in the way of the fire access or a ball wall, or sometimes just the needed classroom portables that are placed. So in this particular case, there's a equipment that is in the way that prohibits the access towards the back, but that can easily be resolved. In this case, we are proposing to widen the fire access for this campus, just as an example of others as well. And this particular campus, again, Crown Valley, has a number of ADA issues because it's built on tiers. If we're looking at the kindergarten classrooms located on the
the left side of the screen towards the right, there's quite a significant grade elevation change. And we know that in order to make an accessible site and have a path of travel, that there will be some type of ramp system that will be required, and you can see that we're showing ramping towards the lower levels. Now, we didn't do an extensive topographic survey, and when projects do develop, that will need to be done in order to determine the best path of travel and the lengths of these ramps, but we are aware that those will be necessary. Here we're looking at R.H. Dana Elementary School and exceptional needs. And as we were meeting with all of the principals and visiting the campuses, we quickly realized that the educational support programs really do impact your campuses. And educational support programs we labeled as like preschool, YMCA, Link, CAFE, Kinder Plus, all of these programs really impact the schools. And the main issues that were brought up to us from the school's perspective was that it was a safety issue and it created traffic. And the safety issue was brought up because many of these programs are in portables towards the back of the campuses. So you have parents who need to drop off and pick up throughout the day, in some cases for preschool, and they have to walk way deep into the campus and so forth, and for pickup for YMCA as well. So there's a lot of adults who are coming in and out. I know different campuses have tried to address this through badges or just some way of identifying who is coming on campus. So that this is a safety concern. What we propose to do for the master plans is to locate these types of programs towards the front of the school to limit the distance that parents have to drop off. And also, where it was possible, there's always site constraints, but where it was possible, if it was possible where we were proposing a parking lot, for example, in this case, that we locate them close to that parking lot to ease the traffic as well. And here we're looking at San Clemente High School, and as Bob described, the minimum essential facilities were reviewed for every one of your campuses, and we did, with the help of John Forney, have information from plans that were reviewed, and we scanned them and got information for floor plans to get some square footage so we can be able to compare to the California Department of Education standards. And where the schools were found deficient, as Bob mentioned, is where we proposed an expansion or an addition. And here we're looking at an administration expansion at the very front of the campus. And as Bob was mentioning as well, the plumbing fixture count was done, and we have it quantified in each one of the, for each one of the schools, and provided an overall count for all of the schools. And for the high schools, it's definitely the ones that need most facilities. So what we had to do in the case of San Clemente High School, for example, where the girls' water closets are under so much, 45 water closets, for example, is that we have to quantify that and provide the square footage for added toilet facilities. In this case, for example, we are proposing restroom buildings within the courtyard to make up for the water closets that are needed. Wherever there is a proposed classroom or new administration, we propose toilet facilities to make up for those needed. And
Here we'd just like to highlight again the fire access and ADA issues. In some cases, we have schools that are kind of courtyard type, and so in this case, there's really just landscaping that needs to be removed in order to provide the adequate fire access for these core, the center of these facilities here. There's some ADA issues for some portables here, so we know that we will need some type of ramp to access that level. And this is Miguel Hills Middle School, and as Bob mentioned, we're highlighting here the need for a gymnasium. And as you can see, there's a lot of orange on this particular campus, so you can see that there's classrooms are needed, expansion for the locker room area. We're proposing a library media center and more classrooms. But all of this, we're trying to work together to create a campus that is efficient and will meet the criteria of the California Department of Ed.
I think the main thing that we were looking for in all the master plans was not that they represent a final solution for any campus, but they represent the components that need to be addressed and that they give you some kind of roadmap so that if you know you need to add relocatables or the campus is going to expand, you have some logical way of looking at it and moving forward. The deliverables that we're providing to the district come in a couple of forms. One is the executive summary that we provided the board tonight, and it has the topics there: introduction, goals, objectives, demographics, facility survey information, a lot of summary of the project, design standards, funding analysis, and then projects and budgets. And it gives you a lot of those quantified numbers that Betty was just mentioning in terms of numbers of fixtures, numbers of unique circumstances that seem to be reoccurring on campuses. And then the other deliverable is the binders that we've prepared, which are really, they come in two different, these binders over here, this stack of books you see along the edge, it's not an Encyclopedia Britannica, it's actually your master plan. It's broken into two volumes for each family. So there's basically six families. In volume one, it has similar information that's in the executive summary, but all the detailed background information that goes with it, aerial photographs, facility surveys, all that. And then volume B gives you all the backup information. That contains the field assessments, all the detailed cost estimates, as well as all of the photographs that came with each site. We've also provided the district a lot of this information on disk so that they can have PDFs of all the images and that kind of stuff. But this is kind of a hard delivery of the hard documents so that you have something that you can look at. And we're hoping that this will be kind of a living tool for the district so that they can use it, you can modify it, and as projects come up, you can refer to it and move the projects forward. So I think that's about the end of the presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Trustee Bryson?
Yes, first of all, I'd like to thank you for such a wonderful, comprehensive, easy to understand every aspect of what needs to be done on every campus, the color coding and all of the insight that you gained from the school sites and everything is enormously impressive, and I personally am ecstatic. There's only one question that I have left, and it's a question that I've had from when I actually ran for this office to this moment, and I still am concerned about it. What are the state standards for example, Dana and the other schools, elementary, middle, and high schools? Don't they require cafeterias? I'll never forget the first time I walked onto the Dana campus and saw all the children sitting on the ground or on walls or wherever they could. And in some of the elementary schools, the same problem. Don't they have a requirement and a standard that all the children of any age have a place to sit and eat like they do in the schools I see all over the country, and yet I don't see them in this district?
They do. They have a requirement for a multi-purpose building at all elementary schools. Now, some districts choose not to allow the kids to eat in the multi-purpose, and they'll treat them more as an assembly hall, and kids will eat outside, but you shouldn't have an elementary school that has no multi-purpose space.
Has that been addressed in the
documents? Yes. Any of the schools that are lacking would show new multi-purpose buildings on the master plan.
The other thing is, what about the teenagers? I mean, I think they should have a right to sit down to eat lunch as much as first, second, third, fourth, fifth.
If I could address Dana Hill specifically, and, well, actually even Capo Valley as well, because they eat in their multipurpose room, and based on the review of the minimum essential facilities, it was found to be very small. So there are proposed expansions, and especially for those two campuses where there really isn't much open space, we're proposing outdoor courtyards just for that reason.
What kind of, for wind, I had students talk to me on several occasions about the fact that even on a nice day, the wind, you know, if there's a Santa Ana wind, they are sitting outside confronting all of that at the same time, they're, you know, it takes away from their ability to really relax, and all students are under a lot of stress these days. They're all trying to do well. They all want to do well. So why not provide something? Is there some way we can provide some cover for them while they're eating? Or do they have to just be out there in a courtyard?
Well, the courtyards are right outside of the existing buildings.
And right, I've walked through a lot of them.
Right, and
they don't look very comfortable to me. That's just a question I personally have had for a long time, because everywhere else I go, well, I see all the students sitting in cafeterias to have lunch, and here, you know, our children don't have that.
I think California got used to the idea of kids being outside, and so it seems like multipurpose buildings aren't very large. But they should be large enough. Typically for an elementary school, the multipurpose building would be large enough to seat about half of the kids. So you should be able to have two lunches and have kids in two shifts. It's just that doesn't happen all the time.
Okay. Trustee Christensen.
I'm ecstatic that this has finally come to us. We've been waiting for this for many, many months. I see there's going to be a lot of reading to be done. I've kind of breezed through the outline, the executive summary that was presented us just as we arrived here at the board meeting tonight during the pauses during the hearing here. And I notice it's pretty much just an outline of the criteria and the methodology used, and just some color overlays, which is similar to what was presented last October. So I'm really anxious to get into the documents. One of the concerns I have is that the facilities need, and also the demographic study that went with it, which school district paid a lot of money for, is pretty much 2 years old now. And some of that stuff is probably outdated. As far as the demographics and their projections, that was totally before any of the downturn in the economy, and things have changed quite a bit. The different schools that probably will not be built because the houses aren't going to be built. It's a total different world now than it was 2 years ago when the bulk of the material was provided to you or was given to you. I don't know if you need to answer this or if Ron needs to, but I have to ask. We were promised that we would have this document August of last year. We're just receiving it tonight. And I also understand that the district has had these books for 2 months. And I'd like to find out why it took so long, why there's so many delays, and why we were not given this information when we've been asking for it for a year.
I think that I'm not sure exactly why it's taken as long, because I know we've completed the work a long time ago, and we've been kind of waiting to present to the board to get to the next level. So I think we've been waiting for each other maybe just to find when's the right time for us to present. My only interpretation is the board's been very busy with other matters of budget and other issues, and that there wasn't a lot of time to address the topic, because we've actually completed the work. I think from our last presentation, which was I think in March, we had a few meetings after March with maintenance and operations to finalize a few changes, but we were essentially complete, you know, following that time period. So we've been kind of waiting to present.
Part of it was dealing with a massive budget problem too. We were focused on the budget, and I think there was a deliberate decision was made to postpone bringing this forward while we were wrestling with the budget.
Who accepted was being prepared by the architect, not by the school district, so therefore they were working independent of the budget. So why was the delay even to March, which is over half a year delay, if that's independent from the budget? And we have been asking for this for months and months and months, and I'm not aware of anyone on this board asking to have it delayed since we wanted it a year ago, August. I'd just like to find out what happened. Okay. Well, I guess the next...
I don't know what to say as far as...
I don't know what happened between August and December. I have a pretty good idea what happened between August and December. In March, then, we did put it on hold until after the budget, but not until this time. So then when Dr. Mahler arrived, we asked that it be revived, and they worked on it over the summer. Why it took so long between last August until February is another issue.
Because, you know, it just brings up a concern that it's already outdated, and that has a concern for me. And I'd also like to ask who on the district staff is going to be reviewing this master plan to make sure it's adequate and that it meets the needs of the district, provides a roadmap of what's going to be presented to us as a board as far as priority projects on a matrix, as far as what's needed school by school, and as far as how it works with the overall school district. I mean, who's reviewing this master plan?
That would fall within my division, so that responsibility would fall on myself and John Forney primarily, given the fact that we have very limited staff within our facilities.
Okay, so yeah, I just don't want it to sit another half a year before it's reviewed to find out if it's adequate for our needs.
Well, let me address a couple of points you made. I think in terms of whether or not the plan is up to date, I think you made a reference that it's already out of date as they're delivering, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. Whenever we do anything of this nature, whether we're doing it with budget or planning, you're always taking a snapshot on a moving picture. The work that they've been doing is a culmination of work basically since I've come on board. So it's within the last 15 months or so they've been primarily working on it. So I think it's fresh. I think it's up to date. I think it's pertinent and current. It would have to be a living document. If you wanted it to always be current and up to date, it would have to be something you would look at on an ongoing basis.
Well, isn't it required that we have to have a master plan and that we have to update it regularly anyway? Isn't it required by the state that we have a master plan on file and that it's updated regularly anyway, and that we were lacking having one anyway?
If you're going for state funding for new construction, you're required to have a facilities master plan on file. That can take on a variety of forms and shapes, from something as simple as an essay in a few, 20, 30 pages, to something as robust as what we've developed. There is no standardized format. In fact, there's actually a form, an outline form you can follow if you don't have a plan, and that will suffice for it. You do want a plan, yes.
Mr. Krish, I'm sorry. Did you want to go on? Mr. Christensen, as far as prioritizing, what I believe that has been done, at least our discussions, Mr. Webb's and Mr. Hensley and myself, the work that is planned in your books, the work that was accomplished this summer, and the work that's planned for this year integrated the master plan contents with work orders that were already existing and with needs that Mr. Forney and his staff went out and discovered as fresh
needs. And that is the basis upon which these documents in your book were developed. So you have this year's priorities, and those priorities are the integration of all of those variables which I just mentioned. The reason that you don't see anything massive in terms of construction, additions to buildings, modernization, large capital projects, is we have no funding. So the priorities had to be developed within the current funding base we knew we would have available. What our district really requires is vision and ability to acquire funding for the larger massive projects. And we could also probably use an asset management plan to look at what we might lease, what we might sell, in order to get some capital to invest in the buildings that we currently have.
Actually, I wasn't referring to new construction whatsoever, so that doesn't apply. What I'm referring to is the things like ADA, which you mentioned, you know, you went through that, fire and safety, as far as finding things where we're going, where we have liability from someone getting injured for whatever reason, or just, you know, there's so many schools and there's thousands of things like this. They have nothing to do with new construction. That's what I want to make sure that these documents prioritize in a good matrix that can be presented to us, or we can find it and say, okay, site 37, that has priority because of whatever reason, and these are priority items because of this reason, but it has precedence over site 52. You know, that kind of thing to keep us so that we're up to date in code, that there's not going to be a fire somewhere and a fire truck, as you mentioned, can't get to a site and the school site burns down. Those are the priority things that I'm looking for, that I'm hoping are in this thing and easy to find, and that can be assessed by staff to give to the board, say, here's what we need to do next year. These are the funds we have for it, or need to get for it, so that we can say, okay, there's 50 items, we've got to take care of them regardless, we have to find the funding. There's something else that maybe a roof that, although it's not a code requirement, if you don't repair it, the next rain's going to collapse it. You know, those kind of things is what I want to see in this master plan, and that's what I'm hoping is going to be addressed by staff, and as though it's adequate and all those things are in there.
All the base information that you're talking about is contained in the cost estimates and the photographs, and they're all numbered in a similar fashion, so that if you're looking for ADA compliance for door hardware, what do we have as far as door hardware problems, you can look at that line item on every school site, and it falls within the same numbering system. So you can even take a topic, say door hardware, what do we need to do district-wide as door hardware, we can go through all the estimates, collect all that information, and you can see the cost impact. So we'd be happy to sit down with staff and go through the binders in detail just to make sure that everybody understands where the information is and how to find it. And I think everything you're asking for is there. It's just a matter of knowing how to navigate through it to pull those items out.
Okay, and that's what I'm hoping staff can present to us.
We will work with Bob on that and go through those documents and then begin to pull that out and develop the prioritized list based on fire life safety, basically the safety and major maintenance leaky roof thing that's going to create another type of problem. Mm-hmm. We will do that. We will work through that over the next couple of months and bring that back to you.
Because otherwise the master plan
is a document that sits on a shelf and we do nothing with it.
And it's a waste of money.
We'll do that.
Any further questions? Comments? Thank you. very much for your presentation.
I actually have a...
Oh, I beg your pardon.
A question and a comment. First of all, I agree with Trustee Bryson as far as the courtyard versus the cafeteria. Cafeteria is far more effective from a student standpoint. Gets hot during the... when it gets close to spring and summer. But that aside, site adequacy, I know, is going to be something to look for, because that, as you showed with the chart, is something that is developing each and every year as our school, as our students, as our schools grow. So, but a lot of these schools don't have room to grow. So I was wondering how you plan to attack the site adequacy problems with the overpopulated schools such as Dana Hills.
I think our main approach is to not show more facilities on the site than they can reasonably handle. So I think for Dana Hills, the ultimate build-out is going to be substantially less than maybe Capistrano Valley High School, because it just doesn't have the land.
Okay.
That's basically what you do, is you have to size the school down to match the capacity of what the site can do.
So when there's no more room in such schools such as Dana Hills, there's nothing you can do? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we work on a lot of urban sites, too. We built a high school on a five-acre site, and you just go up. So it just depends on the nature of the community and what you're looking for.
Okay.
Thank you. Are we ready to move on?
We are.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would like to take a moment and just acknowledge the immense amount of work that has gone into this by Bob and his staff, as well as district staff, and tying in with that. This is, even though it has been delivered much later than we had all hoped and anticipated, there has been hours and hours of work that has gone into it, and they have delivered a rather robust, complete set of documents that will take us quite a while to dig through.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Item number 36, Board Policy Revision. Consideration and approval, first reading of Board Policy 5111.1, District Residency. Ms. Watkins.
Good evening. We are looking to revise this board policy in light of the fact that the old policy talks about adding portables and relocatable classrooms, and in light of our budget crisis, we are not wanting to look at that possibility at that time. Also, because of what we're doing in first grade with our 25-to-1 class size reduction and with our state and education code mandates, we are hoping to be able to make some changes in our board policy to kind of fit with what we're actually doing this year. In this board policy, and what we have done in the past, is after schools and after the initial opening of schools, and we have the opportunity to relook at our staffing, at that time we make our adjustments, and that's about this time of the year. And after we make our initial adjustments, our hope and dream is to not reorganize schools as new students enter the schools. And
trustee comments? Looking for a recommendation to waive the second reading and adopt this.
I move we waive second reading and adopt the revised policy.
Thank you. Further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Oh. Aye.
All opposed? Nay. The motion carries 7-0. That concludes our open session portion. Do we have any comments by the trustees? Our superintendent has a comment to make, if we could give her a moment.
Just a little preview of what you'll see in the newspaper, but you won't see the test. You won't see the themes. You'll just see test scores. So Michelle Benham has provided us with some very interesting highlights, and I think I'm going to allow Michelle the pleasure, because she has done all the work. And I was originally going to do it, but she has spent an inordinate amount of time analyzing our test scores, and she is going to give you only half. She's going to tell you about what the themes are in the API test scores of the STAR testing, and in October you'll learn more about the AYP. Michelle? And I'm going to just preview down to the line. She gets excited about this stuff, you know. So, you know, front and back, one page. And
is that right?
We can dispense with all of it. And because I never have been in the business of comparing districts before, I wasn't real comfortable with some of the comments on Michelle's report. So I'm letting her do that herself so that if there are any quotes anywhere, it wasn't Mahler that was putting down Saddleback or some of these other places, because I have to work with those superintendents. Before Michelle gives her report, it's important for the people here to understand that the scores that the state looks in a range between are 200 and 1,000, with the goal 6 years ago, or 6 or 7 years ago, being that every single school in the state of California would be 800. That was the goal. I remember very clearly at the beginning of the STAR testing that schools were scoring in the 200s. If you were doing really well, you were in the 500, 600, 700s. And I just think that you'll be very interested to know where CAPO currently is. It's impressive. So go ahead, Michelle. You have the bragging rights.
Thank you. I learned bragging rights at UCLA. So we do have a lot to celebrate. Our staff and students and families have worked very hard, and we thank you for your support and guidance through this process. We are very proud to announce that our academic performance index district-wide is 857. That means we grew 21 points. The state and county average was 14 points growth, so we exceeded that by a large range. If you want, tomorrow you could look up Saddleback's growth. But we did finally eclipse Saddleback in our district-wide API. And so we won't rest on our laurels, though, because we feel like it's continuous improvement is our goal, so we have to look at our neighbors to know where we want to go. 88% of our schools now have 800 or higher API scores, 42% in the state, so that's a marked difference. 95% of our schools grew this year. 84% of those schools grew by double digits. And that's huge. When you're already above 800, to grow by double digits is a big, big achievement. Las Palmas Elementary grew by 71 points. And that is the fourth highest growth in the whole county. Vista Del Mar Middle School grew by 62 points. That ties for the highest middle school growth. These are of traditional schools. I'm not counting small schools or charter schools in that statistic. And San Juan Hills High School grew by 62 points, and that's the largest high school, traditional high school growth in the county. 900 has now become the goal for which we're reaching, and we have 15 schools over that line. Three of those are middle schools. There's only one other district in the county that has three or more middle schools at 900, and that's just about 20 minutes north of us where Dr. Mahler used to work.
I don't compete with Saddleback. I go for the gold. I go to compete with Irvine.
All six of our comprehensive high schools are above 800.
only Saddleback and Irvine of the unified districts in Orange County. Those are the only two other districts that have more than one high school that are all over 800. So that's a very good company that we're holding. And there's a lot more. Oh, we are still the only large school district in the state above 800. So we're very proud of our results.
At SC, we don't have to brag. Everyone knows we're the best.
This is a great way to end a meeting, actually, so. Thank you all. We are recessed to closed session.